You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, the Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm found. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See as the raven flies, and time slips by. Valar, my rulers, all men must die.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television series. I am your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And tonight we'll be talking about season 4 premiere, episode 401, entitled Two Swords.
I feel like we should have come up with a little more obscure and complicated names for this show.
They should have called it like Five Swords.
No. I mean for
five
us.
Five Sporks.
As hosts, we need names that are very similar to each other and spelled completely weird and hard to memorize. How about that?
So your name would be Jim and my name would be Jin.
Yes, yeah.
With two N's. Uh-huh. Or no, it'd be my name would be Jim, J-I-M-N.
Okay, and I could spell mine J-Y-M.
There you go.
Perfect.
All right, Jim. first off, apologies for the feed situation. As you know, if you listen to our preseason cast, we transitioned from our Night's Watch brand to this the generic form, Game of Thrones podcast, and we renamed. Jim put a little witticism, the famous Jim Jones witticism. He called us in the show description the God of Tits and Wine, and Steve Jobs rose from the grave, said tits on my iTunes, and banned us. We got instant banned by some fucking robot, and it's taken us almost 2 weeks to get that all worked out. But our old feed is reestablished. If you are listening to the new feed, you're doing something wrong because it doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, I apologize for jerking you around like that, but we now got everything back, and hopefully we'll be good going forward.
Another apology. I'm still sick at the moment. We did the preview cast. I think I was sick at that point. So my voice is not 100%. You'll probably hear me coughing in the background, but I'll try to keep it to a minimum.
Yeah, miraculously, despite our open mouth kissing on a nightly basis, I have not been sick throughout your 2 week ordeal.
Yeah.
Thank Christ.
Well, one of the weeks
all
was
all the old gods and the new.
Yeah. All right.
Are we going to do another famous Jim Jones witticism?
No. I was just trying to fill time while you took a drink.
Give credit to where credit's due. We are using Arya's Prayer by Dominic Omega. Off the HBO licensed, or what do they call that? When
commissioned
HBO commissioned hip hop remix album called Catch the Throne. You can get the whole thing for free at soundcloud.com/catchthethrone. Unfortunately, we're probably not going to be using this for long because we don't really, you know, we like to use stuff that we have the rights fully secured for, and you know, 30 seconds fair use, blah blah blah. But I don't want to get sued. I've actually reached out to two people on SoundCloud to use some of their Game of Thrones music, and hopefully next week we'll return with something from that. So if you hated Arya's prayer, hang tight. It's leaving. If you loved it, go to soundcloud.com/catchthethrone and grab the whole album. I actually enjoy it. What did you think of this episode?
Huh. As a season opener, it was... it was good. I mean, I like the ending a lot. That final scene with Arya and the Hound is really good. Mm. There's a lot of cool action in there. I don't know. I mean, some of the stuff, I just can't stand to watch Joffrey do his thing, especially when he's so smug about it.
Sure.
So a lot of that stuff was kind of annoying to me, especially when, you know, Jaime's kind of become a character we like now.
Sure.
So... I don't like when he gets smacked down by an insolent little child.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, it was good. It was definitely a good episode. There were just parts of it that kind of annoyed me.
I thought it was great. I too have a problem with Lannisters being triumphant, and it's hard to stomach the opening scene, which we'll talk about here in a bit, where Ned's sword got melted down and reforged as Lannister blades. It's a lot to take, and Joffrey's statue, and you know, it seems like the two Lannisters we do like get massively disrespected.
Yep.
But I thought it was a strong opener to kind of reestablish where we are at, and the final 10 minutes were just fantastic, which we'll get to. Let's go on to the recap. Of course, this is episode called Two Swords, and it's a total Double D production. That's Dan Weiss and David Benioff. This was his directorial debut. David got a poke at the series last season. This is his first time at the helm, and it was written by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. So, again, top to finish, it's a Double D production. It premiered to 6.64 million households watching it, or people watching it. People,
is that
households.
A lot? That doesn't sound like a lot, because I'm used to the Walking Dead numbers.
It's for premium cable, it's a phenomenon. And it's 1.2, 1.3 million than last season's... finale. And then they say, yeah, I read on off season that up to 6 million people pirate it. Somehow they measure that. So that, if you put all those numbers together, that's about Walking Dead numbers. And it's just it's probably the biggest hit HBO has ever had. I'd have to do a little bit more research before I said that with confidence. But, in fact, Monday, Game of Thrones was renewed by HBO for two seasons.
The day after the premiere?
It's the first time they've actually authorized two full seasons.
Yeah. As if there was ever a question if they'd renew this thing.
Yeah, apparently not. you know, that's probably not enough to get them to the end, or I know it's not enough to get them to the end, but still, it's pretty impressive.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So let's get right to the episode. I said something in the in the instant take, where I was disappointed that we don't have a Stark theme song. Apparently I was wrong, and Rob S. sent in a correction via Reddit that there is a Winterfell theme. And if you notice, the music, there's this haunting violin arrangement that plays from the time we first see Ice to the time Tywin Lannister steps forward very villainously. Then the Reigns of Casimir take over, but that 15-20 seconds was the Winterfell theme.
It's so hard to tell that theme in this episode, at least, because like you said, it morphs into the Lannister theme, Reigns Castamere. And then at the end of the episode, you said they also play it, but it morphs into the general Game of Thrones theme. And it's actually, it doesn't even morph there. It's underneath.
Yeah. It's
the theme.
It's what happens when your theme music is for a house that gets everyone beheaded, betrayed, throat slits, sold into bondage. I mean, it's the kind of music that would play for a house that just gets completely fucking owned at every level.
Well, it feels like that's a good way to do it in this episode, because not only is the swords a slap in the face to the Starks, but at the end of the episode, it doesn't even let their theme play then either. Right. It's just like, you guys are an afterthought now.
Right. And it just, as a Stark fan, it feels like such a violation to see Ned's blade, who's been in the Stark house for thousands of years, handed down since the kings, since the Starks were the kings in the North and not just lords. To have that great ceremonial ancestor blade melted down for these prick Lannisters to make, you know, two swords out of. It's kind of like, it almost felt like it was filmed like a sexual assault. You know, two guys hold this thing down, they knock off its clothing, its hilt, and then they just have their way with it. Mm. And it's gross. I hated it. And then then Tywin just throws the wolf pelt onto the forge, which
is almost more insulting to me, because, I'm not a big lore guy.
Okay.
The sword being 2,000 years old, whatever, it's not that fancy of a sword. but when he throws that fucking awesome wolf sheath into the fire, I couldn't believe it. I was so sad to see that go, because it's such a cool
smell.
Sheath.
My God.
Ooh, yeah.
A 2,000-year-old dire wolf pelt.
And Stark sweat.
You know how many dire wolves and wolves and hounds have pissed on that thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty bad. Anyway, we go from there right into the intro, which had a couple of cool new things. Three new things I noticed. They had the Dreadfort, which I thought was cool because the towers popping out looked very meat tenderizer-y.
Mm.
And their sigil being the flayed man makes sense.
The Dreadfort is where?
That is the head fortress, or the homeland for the Boltons, who were two of the architects of the Red Wedding. The Freys was one, and then Roose Bolton was the other, the betrayed Robb. That's where Theon's being held.
Okay.
And we also see another location, Meereen, which is the greatest of the slave cities around the Gulf of Grief. Dany's worked her way up the coast, and it's kind of like a video game. She keeps leveling up. You know, you had Astapor, and then you had son of a bitch. Yes, Yunkai. God damn, I forgot it. Yeah, Astapor, then Yunkai, and then Meereen. And you can notice it's visibly bigger and more impressive than the other.
Although, smaller harpy, I think. The harpy on Yunkai was so big, it looked out of place.
I think Yunkai were compensating for
probably.
You know, you got a harpy that big. One thing I thought was confusing is they had a really technically impressive swooping shot where the camera blasts into, you know, wind up toy world orbit and does like a 180 degree turn where it seems like it's going north again, but it's actually shooting all the way down to the tip of Westeros south, swooping over the arm of Dorne, which is, we talked about in a preseason, is kind of like the Florida state peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
All along the archipelago called the Stepping Stones over to Essos, which is the eastern continent off of Westeros, then up the three slave cities. And I thought when I was watching it, holy shit, that's confusing, because
it was.
The map does, I think, a very good job of showing people where things are related, but when it does that kind of suborbital gymnastics, it might have been hard to follow for people. And I know you found it kind of confusing too.
I thought they just went straight south with it, right, instead of east.
We come back from the pre-season, or the pre-credit sequence, or the credit sequence rather, and Tywin's presenting one of the new swords to Jaime. You notice that one of the swords is significantly shorter than the other.
Yeah, when they were pouring it in the mold. And I don't know where that other sword is going.
Who would you suppose it'd go to?
Tyrion. Being shorter, I don't know.
Okay, all right. That's mildly,
or probably
interesting.
More likely, Joffrey.
All right, solid speculation there.
So he can't just be the crossbow king, right?
He's going to try to put a sword into a crossbow and invent some new horrific weapon. Jaime, we see that Tywin plans for Jaime to forsake the Kingsguard, or to be set aside as the Lord Commander, and then make his way back to Castle Rock and rule in his stead and be his rightful heir. Jaime, not so much. Completely rebuffs the offer. Why do you think Jaime defies Tywin here?
I think that Jaime, after being called a Kingslayer and an Oathbreaker, takes this oath very seriously, being the Kingsguard. I don't think he wants to break that oath.
Again.
break an oath again and really just like double Oathbreaker.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, double Oathbreaker on you. Do you think... I think that, his experience with Brienne, which is this shining paragon of Westerosi knighthood, even though she's not technically a knight, has really affected him.
Yeah.
And her winning her respect has, in a maybe not so weird way, allowed him to find his own self-respect. Mm-hmm. But as a result, Tywin kicks him out of the family, disowns him, says that you're a man without a sword hand, and now you're a man without a family. But Jaime saunters out head held high. And I thought that was a very interesting contrast, because I think they deliberately shot and framed that and blocked that last scene of him walking out to be a mirror image of Tyrion walking out after his father told him that he could not have Castle Rock.
Sure.
It's a nice contrast. Tyrion came in to ask for it, was denied. Jaime came in, was offered, and denied.
Yeah.
And Tyrion walked out pissed off and dejected, and Jaime walked out head held high and swagger. So that was really cool. We then go outside of King's Landing, where Tyrion is waiting alongst the King's Road to meet the Dornishmen arriving from south. Mm-hmm. We find out from the Dornishmen in question that Prince Oberon has arrived early. First of all, it's a shock to Tyrion that Prince Oberon was the one that they sent. He was expecting his older brother, who is very mild-mannered, elderly, has a bad case of the gout.
Yeah, he was not only shocked, he was nervous, you could tell.
Because he's like, "Haha, we'll be happy to have a warrior of Prince Oberon's reputation." So we kind of get a little bit of badass flavor before we even see the guy.
Yeah.
And they decide that they're going to have to track him down, but since he has a famous sexual appetite, he's famous for fucking half of Westeros, that they're going to try some brothels.
I got to say, for the warrior reputation that precedes him here, yellow balls is a terrible sigil. I mean, yellow implies cowardice, in my opinion.
Yellow lemons.
And having yellow balls really implies cowardice.
True, but did you get the sigils for the other houses of Dorne? It was a vulture clutching a dead baby. There was a crowned skull. I mean...
Yeah, where does yellow balls fit in there? I don't think it does.
You know, that's one of the sillier houses.
Okay, kind of all right.
But he's a lot of fun. He pays for everyone's bar tab, and they kind of made him a great house as a joke. There's actually nothing to those sigils. You know, people are free to research it, but they're just a little detail I think thrown into books to show that as our first glimpse that Podrick might not be a complete dumbass, because he's kind of been played as a fool to this point,
except in bed.
Except in bed, where the man knows clearly what he's doing. He's
prodigy.
Yeah. But I think this is a first inclination. There might be more to him than meets the eye.
So you said that there's nothing to those sigils. Do you mean that the lion and the wolf don't indicate anything about the spirit of...
No. I mean that for those particular sigils, there's okay. If you go to look at their entry on the Westeros Wikipedia, which I do not recommend you do if you haven't read the books...
Okay.
It's just basically, that's the horse, or that's the house, and that's the sigil, and they're from Dorne.
Oh, all right.
There isn't, there's no great deeds or other characters. Anyway, we go to the brothel in question, and then we're introduced to the prince and his paramour, picking out whores. This show's famous for its sex position, but I thought this went a lot further than just being mere sex position. I thought that we found out a lot about the characters, showing rather than telling. They don't like timidity. They're not They're not overly proud of their titles. They're not overly concerned with the status of their relationship.
The fact that they're bastards, you know?
He's not.
Well,
she is,
yeah.
And she in question is Ilaria Sands. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's not her real last name. That's just what they call bastards down at Dorne, just like they call bastards up North Snow.
Yeah.
And so forth. So we find a lot of things about these two. Number one, it seems like they have a very passionate relationship that's a very open relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Were it any open, further open, you probably couldn't even call it a relationship.
Sure.
What did you think about the, not the hint, not the implication, the fact that Prince Oberon is a bisexual?
It seems like there's plenty of that in this world. I didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary, honestly.
It's interesting the way they portrayed it. It's almost like he doesn't care where he gets his pleasure from. He likes exceptional, beautiful things, and if it's going to lead to his gratification, he's all for it. Man, woman.
It seems like
goats,
that comes
apparently, if you believe Braun.
And some olive oil, yeah. It appears that the warrior status kind of comes along with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's just out to kill and have fun and like do his own thing, you know? So whether it comes to sex or war, either one of those, he's in it for fun.
Right on.
Can I say that the blonde hair guy in this and the guy who he's seducing here, he has the mouth of Andy Sandberg, doesn't he?
He's a little Sandbergian, sure.
Okay, all right. I wasn't sure if I was the only one who saw that.
His sigil is a lonely island. He also is the guy, same guy that seduced Sir Loras last year that got information for Littlefinger. So, a little wink to last season. So as they're making their final selections, and they're about to get down to business, he hears two Lannisters singing the Reigns of Castamere, goes down to challenges them, informs them that they're not lions, they're little pink men. They're far too slow in the draw, and demonstrates the point by impaling one of their wrists as he reaches for his longsword.
This was absolutely perfect, in my opinion, because by saying you're far too slow on the draw, and his sword sitting right on the table, he knows where his hand is going to be when he reaches for that sword.
Right.
So it's not like he has to guess and try to turn this to his advantage. He's already done it just by putting the challenge out there.
Right, right. It reminded me a little bit of the scene from Justified where Raylan was trying to outdraw this famous quick draw artist, and instead of reaching for his gun, he actually used his foot to yank the tablecloth, so it went out of the guy's reach.
Yeah.
But I thought it's a fantastic scene, great way to introduce these two characters. Tyrion walks in, he makes formal introductions to everyone. Seems like Oberon immediately takes a liking to Tyrion and Bronn.
Especially to Bronn.
Especially to Bronn.
I'll probably talk a little in the next scene about why he's keen on Tyrion, but Bronn is a killer.
Yeah.
He's killed enough men to get to where he is, the right men. So I think Oberyn likes that a lot.
And the scene where Oberon's like, we'll need more girls, yes? And Bronn's like nodding yes, and Tyrion's like nodding no. It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of actually comical moments in this episode. Tyrion wants to speak to him alone. They commiserate over the fact that they're both second sons, and that this arguably sending the second son to the wedding invitation is a slight to the Lannisters.
Yeah.
So, but also it seems very dangerous because Oberyn tells a story that we talked about in a preseason cast about how the Lannisters came during the sack of King's Landing after the Mad King was overthrown. And his sister was the princess who was married to Rhaegar, and she had two little children. They were all brutally murdered by the Mountain. And he points out, if your father's henchman killed my family, then your father gave the order. And to tell him when you see him that the Lannisters aren't the only ones to pay their debts.
Yeah, I like that.
Dude seemed like a very dangerous guy, and I do feel like he likes Tyrion, but that scene where he grabbed him by the chin, especially with his status as a dwarf, that is such an insolent, almost beyond the pale personal insult to Tyrion, who did not appreciate it.
I mean, he's royalty.
Yeah.
And to even touch royalty.
He's the uncle to the king.
Is a big deal, let alone
yeah.
the way it happens.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. And, you know, Tyrion wasn't taken, and he's, like, shoved the guy's hand away. But he also knows he's got him dead to rights. Because Tyrion's not dumb. He knows what happened there. So, going to be an interesting wedding, it seems. let's go on to across the Narrow Sea to Dany, who is fawning over her dragons. She's got Drogon in her lap. But then the three dragons start fighting over a dead goat, and she tries to intercede for some reason, and Drogon snaps at her just in time for Jorah to come in and say, "They can never be tamed, Khaleesi, even by the mother." What do you make of the dragons getting bigger, but also wilder?
Yeah, first of all, bigger. God, that's cool. Because last season, they didn't seem this big, like even nearly this big.
They were like Great Danes, maybe.
Yeah, they weren't as big as Daenerys herself. Right. So now this one is towering over her.
It seemed like the size of like a Bengal tiger, I would say, with wings, of course.
Yeah, but it was the black one's bigger than the other two.
Yeah, certainly. I think he might even be a little bit larger than that, like maybe the size of a Kodiak bear.
Yeah, yeah, like the bear that Brienne fought last season.
Yep.
So that was just freaking cool to see these big ass dragons that are actually small ass dragons.
Right.
And are going to get way, way bigger.
Right.
But yeah, when it snaps at her and he reminds her they can't be tamed, not even by their mother, that's gotta be foreshadowing for something, right? I mean, why else show this scene, the way they showed it?
Well, it's certainly mildly interesting.
I assume that she's going to have some trouble keeping these things on a leash.
But we also know it's a historical fact that the Targaryens 300 years ago rode these giant beasts that could big enough to swallow mammoths whole into battle and use them as giant combat engines. So it will be interesting because not a lot of people, no one really that's left alive has any memory of these giant fearsome dragons. The last few dragons died out, you know, 100 years ago, and they were very stunted, sickly specimens.
Yeah.
You know, no one really knows how that would all work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, if she's going to make that happen, it's, I think up until now, fans of the show could assume that, like, oh, these dragons are going to get bigger, and they're going to follow her verbal commands and all that stuff. And now we're starting to see that, you know, maybe Drogon's thinking, yeah, I like my head scratched. But why am I going to listen to what this you know, pink little woman has to say?
Yeah.
When it comes time to my food.
This is really the first indication of that at all.
Yeah, that it might not be just Dany with dragons, boom. It's
yeah.
You know. So they're dangerous. Speaking of dangerous, we find out that Daario and Grey Worm have been holding Dany up because they're gambling over who has the privilege of riding up front with her in the convoy. Mm-hmm. My bet would be on the eunuch that has been trained over psychological and chemical conditioning to feel no pain and not be tired, but
and can have his nipples cut off without moving.
Yeah. But Dany comes in there, puts an end to it, punishes them both by having to walk at the rear of the train, which is a pretty grave Dothraki insult. And we see a significant look between Grey Worm and Missandei. What do you think's up with that, Jim?
That's a good question, because immediately after that look, Daario starts to say, oh, you like her?
Yeah, like what you see?
Got no use for that, nothing in your pants.
Scabbard's empty.
And he tells him that he's not a smart man. And that to
Grey
me
Worm
says...
Does.
Yeah, Grey Worm tells Daario that he's not a smart man. That to me says that this is not what Daario is implying.
Mm-hmm.
It's some other kind of relationship. Maybe it's just a mutual respect that they were both once slaves. Now they've been freed, and they just have a bond over that.
Yeah, so this isn't something in the books, so I can speculate a little bit and share some stuff I saw on Reddit. Some people wondered if this was a sign that maybe they're going to retcon Grey Worm and Missandei, who were hanging out in the same city and seemed to be roughly of an age and actually maybe even have similar looks about them, that they're actually brother and sister. Like she was raised,
like legitimate brother and sister.
Legitimate brother and sister. That she was raised to be a translator. He was raised to be this, you know, combat eunuch, and okay. that he cares for her on that kind of level. And something that Madbrew and I used to talk about is anytime they can take when they consolidate characters and kind of change things, we like it when they add these extra connections, because the more connections characters have between each other, the more dramatic possibilities you can introduce into the storyline.
And also the more diverse the kinds of connections, I think,
sure.
the more interesting the story gets as well, because we've seen romantic interest everywhere in this show.
Sure.
So if we see, well, we've also seen brother and sister interest as well, sometimes combined. But I think, you know, it might be interesting, even if they weren't brother and sister, that maybe this slave bond is a new kind of bond that we haven't seen yet, and that right. could have interesting implications.
Right. Let's move on to Sansa and Shay and Tyrion. Sansa is inconsolable now that she's found out what's the details of the Red Wedding, and she knows that her brother's head got cut off and was defiled by having his Grey Wind's head sewn onto the body. Mm-hmm. And Shay tries to comfort her. She offers him lemon cakes, which she doesn't want to eat. And I'm like, shit. I knew Sansa was fucking distraught once I saw her turn down lemon cakes.
Yeah, the pigeon pie, eh. Yeah, I turned that down,
you
too.
Take a lead pigeon pie, but Sansa's all about the lemon cakes, man.
Yeah.
So Tyrion dismisses Shay, which she doesn't seem to like overly much, and tries to comfort Sansa on a more personal basis by grabbing her hand and saying, what can I do? And Sansa's like, you can do nothing.
Yeah.
Sansa's,
he's part of the problem, honestly.
I mean, Sansa's life is kind of shitty. She is she's a glorified hostage on her best day. That's her steady state life.
Yeah.
Then you add to the fact that her family's been slaughtered. She's under the custody. She's married off to the, you know, in her mind, probably the worst of the Lannisters.
Hmm. Really? Why do you say that? Because Joffrey is obviously...
Well, her expanse of Lannisters is Joffrey
and Cersei.
The worst
of the family, yeah.
And maybe Tyrion is nice, and I know that Margaery was trying to sell her on that, but he's still a Lannister, and he's... Sure. You know, she, arguably one of the best catches of the kingdom, and as another way to mock and humiliate the Starks, she's been... She got married off to the stunted, unloved, unappreciated... afterthought of Tywin's lineage that he plans to, you know, no further indulge. True, he'll be the Lord of Winterfell, but that's something that's good for him, not good for Sansa. It's just, it's you know, it's another humiliation to the Starks, basically.
Sure.
What did you think about the look that Shay fires off to Tyrion when he grabs her hand?
Oh my god. Just freaking play it cool, Shay. I mean... They're trying to keep this relationship secret. There's no way that's going to happen with her. She's given dirty looks to his wife. She's just not leaving the room when he asks for privacy.
Right.
She's going to blow it.
Yeah, and it's...
She's showing up in the next scene in his chambers.
Rolling on the next scene, she shows up in his chambers, which presumably is Sansa's chambers, too.
Uh-huh.
And she tries to seduce him. She says it's been weeks since they've touched each other. And Tyrion's like, it's not a good time. Everyone whose last name is Tyrion or Lannister either wants me dead or humiliated. And so do the Martells, which is Prince Oberon's family. So it's pretty bad. But she thinks that, you know, it can all be solved by the power of the pussy.
Sure.
And... he rejects her, but then she throws in his face Varys coming to try to buy her off last season. Something we kind of debated whether she was going to think that that was from Tyrion or not. But
she seems
to accuse him, and she doesn't seem to believe his denials either.
Yeah, I agree.
And like you said, inability to play it cool because she starts screaming and shouting. She storms out. And wouldn't you know it, one of Sansa's lady maids overhears it and looks on with her own look of mild interest.
Yeah.
Next scene, we're still in King's Landing. Jaime's being fitted with a golden hand by Qyburn, the disgraced maester. Some comedy here with Cersei just being a professional drunk at this point. I loved, you know, her saying, I spent days with the goldsmith, and Jaime's like cocks an eyebrow, says days, and she like twirls her cup and says, better part of an afternoon.
Yeah.
It's so
showing
good.
That she doesn't really care that much.
No, she's just drinking with a purpose as well.
Yeah.
She also thanks Qyburn for his help in that other matter.
The other matter?
The other matter. The symptom that he was able to help relieve for her. You think it's heartburn?
No, I doubt it.
Intestinal gas?
I doubt it.
Bunions. It's got to be bunions. Wearing high heels all the time has got to be murder.
Yeah, I doubt it.
What do you think it is?
See, what would Cersei be up to while Jaime was out? The line at the end of this that he's just too late.
Well,
means
we know,
maybe she's been hooking up with somebody else.
Well, we know for a fact she was fucking Lancel, which is one of the...
Yeah, who is Lancel?
Lancel's one of the Lannister cousins. He was the kind of the sickly looking dude that he also murdered, arguably, Robert by getting him drunk.
So I'm wondering if there aren't symptoms from that. I mean, you got to think that these kings and princes and people are going to have some sort of diseases because they just fuck all the time.
I think it could just be early onset incest pregnancy, you know? But he gave her a little bit of...
That's her problem, huh?
I don't know. It's not... I don't think I'm using book knowledge on that. It's just... Because this is another thing that they're kind of inventing for the show.
Yeah.
Because they're really doing some heavy lifting in adapting arguably 2.5 books into possibly 2 seasons. So he tries to figure out what's wrong with her. Mm-hmm. She rattles off all of her troubles. You know, Jaime started a war, then fled, got captured. Her husband was tragically murdered in a hunting accident. They had a siege. She had to marry off Joff to a woman that she's intensely jealous of. Her only daughter got shipped off to Dorne, which now knowing what we know about the Dornish, that seems like a much bigger risk than it would have been if you were just watching the show.
Kind
of ignorant of these details. And finally, she, also is betrothed to a quote unquote renowned pillow biter.
Yep.
I think, because you mentioned about Jaime's honor, but I also think he dropped another good reason for why he rejected Tywin's offer. And that's like, if I stay in the Kingsguard, I get to stay here in King's Landing with you.
Mm.
And I won't, because if he went back to Castle Rock, he'd probably be forced to marry.
Yeah.
You know, to continue their line. And the Kingsguard is an easy way for him to dodge all that so he can stay with Cersei, because it seems like the crazy son of a bitch really loves Cersei.
It really does in this scene. And now that he's back, he wants to continue right where they left off.
So why does she reject? We talked about why he rejected Tywin. Why does Cersei reject Jaime?
I think it comes down to just how bitter she is about him being gone. It definitely, like, watching this scene the entire time, I'm saying not his fault on everything she says.
Sure.
He got captured. He literally couldn't be there, or he would have been. But it feels to me like she is still bitter because of that.
Right.
And over those years, or over that year, she has just grown so bitter that now she can't forgive him, even though it's not his fault.
And we know that they were fraternal twins. So they've been together literally since birth. They've been in an intimate relationship since their early teenage years, it seems. So this might be the very first time that she's ever had to go for extended periods, because as soon as she married Robert, Jaime took up the Kingsguard.
Yeah.
So this might be the very first time that they've had to be apart for any extended period of time.
Yeah.
And maybe her that kind of betrayal or that hurt has made her grow cold towards him. I don't know.
Yeah, and there's also in the Blackwater episode, the Hound, of course, leaves the side of the king, just abandons him. Maybe she's a little angry that Jaime wasn't there to help fight that war for them, to help protect King's Landing as well, and, you know, the family and their throne and everything.
Yeah. After Barristan was thrown out, he's the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, for God's sake. She probably thinks that he should have been there fighting. And also, I think there is not any small amount of issue she has with the fact that he's got one hand now.
Okay.
He's got
Does
one
he need
hand.
Two hands to please her? What's going on? Can't get enough purchase with that one hand?
Well, Nina over at Project Fandom's made all the detachable dildo attachments jokes that one could make in a podcast, so I can't really tread on that ground except for to observe that Stump alone. I
mean, oh, yeah.
Jamie's a one-man DP engine now. but no, I think that the Cersei's kind of shallow and vain.
Yeah.
And Jamie was famous for being the best swordsman in the kingdom. And now he's just a dude that couldn't protect her and abandon her when she needed him and maybe not be able to protect him in the future. And that's probably a big blow to their relationship.
Throughout this episode, it does seem like Jamie is determined to still try to be the best. I don't know whether he'll succeed at that, but even with just his left hand, I think he wants to train and become the best again. So that was interesting. One other question I have about this scene, and you mentioned kind of, you know, why Jamie would want to stay here, but do you think the other end of that with Casterly Rock is Tywin trying to get Jamie out of here so that the rumors that have been spreading will be kind of dispelled a little bit?
He did seem overly concerned with that last... I mean, that was the stated reason he's marrying her off to Ser Loras. That, you know, this is going to end these disgusting rumors about you. And if you can split them apart, like, you're at Casterly Rock, you're at King's Landing, you're married. Yes, I definitely see.
Yeah, and if Jaime is so worried about breaking a second oath, what happens when a second marriage is ruined by their incest? That would be bad news for the Lannisters.
Nothing good. That's pretty good insight. So we see the payoff from last scene as Sansa's lady comes in to give a report. Apparently she's been kind of spying on her this whole time. We go just south of the wall. It's looming large in CGI fashion.
I missed that. So Sansa's handmaiden or whatever she is.
She bursts in at the end and says, "Forgive me, you're great." I think she calls
it. So she's telling Cersei about what's going on with Sansa.
Well, not with Sansa, but with Tyrion and
Shay. Yeah, with Tyrion and Shay. Uh-oh. We know what they did. We know what she tried to do to Tyrion's last whore.
She got the wrong whore.
Yeah. Now she might have the right one.
And her son finished a job.
Okay.
So anyway, south of the wall in some godforsaken canyon, Ygritte is making all the arrows. Tormund comes up and accuses her of letting Jon go because apparently she can hit a rabbit in the eye with an arrow from 200 yards. Which, as an abutting archer myself, I laugh heartily. I don't care if you're fucking Legolas, that's not going to happen. But whatever, she's a hell of an archer. Then she accuses him right back of sitting on his ass rather than going to war because she's all about getting out the crows now. And breaking up this debate is the Thins, who come in marching looking fierce as hell. We find out that they're cannibals. And what was your first impression of the Thins?
They look very intimidating. They look like a Romulan from the new Star Trek or something. I think they introduced their cannibalism in a really good way. They kind of roughly hinted at it and then got a little more specific and a little more specific. Once they said marbled, the only commentary during which marbled is appropriate is food.
Right.
And that's exactly what the crows were.
I thought it is interesting because these guys do seem to intimidate even the other wildlings. I gotta say, if you're going to eat a part of a person, I don't know, I'd go with the arm. That's like the equivalent of a chicken wing, right? I mean, when you get the ass and thigh right there, I mean, that's where the real action's at. If you want to introduce someone to roasted crow, to eating crow, not in the sense of having chagrin for your actions, but in literally eating another human being, I'd go with the ass and thighs.
All right, ass and thighs. That's
where the well marbled meat's going to be.
Aaron's an ass and thigh man. Found that out today.
Any other observations on these guys?
Nope.
Does seem like they're just as impatient as Ygritte about getting down to business at the wall, and almost kind of mutinous about not waiting for Mance Rayder. Where do you see that going?
who's mutinous about not
waiting
for
Mance? The Finns are saying that, you know, we want to go. They're kind of like, why are we waiting for Mance's signal? As he famously said, I'm going to light the fire, the big, so big the North has never seen its like, or the biggest fire the North's ever seen. And that's their signal to attack south of the wall.
Yeah.
Why are they in such a damn hurry?
To attack? I don't know. I mean, maybe they just want to get some more marbled meat. Yeah. But it seems like that's a bad plan. I mean, when you can't communicate with your groups across these vast distances and over this giant wall, it seems like the plan you make is the plan you need to stick to once you get across the wall. So going in early is just a recipe for disaster.
But, you know, that's exactly what John told Ygritte last year about why they can't win. You have 100,000 people, but you're no army.
Yeah, good point.
You have no discipline. You've got no training. Your equipment sucks. So, anything else to say before I move on?
Well, the good thing about the Thin Army is they don't have to carry any food with them.
That's true. They don't have to march in their bellies. Light. Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on, at the wall, at the Castle Black, John is talking about Rob to Sam Tarly, and how he wanted to hate him all his life because he's better at everything, and he was a legitimate Stark, had a way with the ladies, but he never could because he's just such a nice guy.
Yep.
Sam confided that he sometimes wanted to hate him too because he's better at everything except for reading. we also know from this and the scene with, I feel like there's a lot of scenes that have established that we are a few weeks, if not a month or two, past where we left off. Jamie's, the condition of his stump was another good symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell that John's, you know, he was on death's door when we last saw him with three arrows sticking out of him. His wounds have begun to heal. He still winces getting dressed. He still has a bit of a limp, but he's strong enough to stand trial.
Yeah,
for being an oath breaker. Alistair Storn, which if you remember, he is the kind of master at arms at the wall. And
guy
he was
who hates John.
He hates John. I never understood fully why he hated John.
Yeah, me either. He demonstrated how good he was at swordplay and stuff, but I don't know why Alistair would hate him for that.
There's probably a book reason I've forgotten. Like, I could see a guy, like, you know, at this time, the wall used to be a fairly prestigious place for second and third sons to go to attain glory, you know, because you can't, you know, you can't really hold lands and titles anyway because your older brother is going to get it. So head up to the wall and see the world and blah, blah, blah. But in John's time, that favor, that the bloom has fallen off the rose. So I wonder if it's like, you know, he's just a very bitter, disillusioned Night's Watchman, and John comes in there all fresh-faced and eager and still thinking this is a good deal, and he just wanted to take him down a peg.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. But we also see Janos Slynt, who we last saw Tyrion banish him to the wall for, among other things, betraying Ned Stark. Tyrion decided he couldn't trust him since he betrayed the Last Hand, so he sent him up to the wall and stripped him of his lands and titles. And he has now become Thorne's chief lapdog. One thing I noticed is Kit Harington's acting as John has taken a huge leap, just judging for this scene and the last one. A lot of people complained about him kind of being a whiner and having a flat effect. But I thought he really was a dynamic and powerful figure, both when he's stalking off saying, I've done plenty wrong. Yeah. And defending himself during the trial. What did you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he feels more like his brother Rob at this point. Or he's growing into that role, which I think is fitting considering the conversation that they have where he has always kind of admired his brother. So now that he has a little bit of experience outside of Winterfell, he's kind of hardening up and becoming a more serious contender.
So the trial goes back and forth with him saying, you know, I didn't kill the Half Hand. I was under orders, but I also broke my oath by sleeping with a woman, a wilding woman at that.
That's silly, right? Because condemning him for sleeping with a wildling when he is undercover with the wildlings is like condemning arresting an undercover cop for doing coke when he's undercover in the drug,
right.
In the drug cartels.
Right.
Like, that's what you send him there to do, so what do you want?
Well, no one accused Janos of being a sharpest sword in the armory. But and the Master Aemon, or Maester Aemon, pretty much points that out. It's like, look, if we beheaded every ranger that slept with a whore in Molestown, we wouldn't, you know, have anybody left to defend us. He also gets really into it with Slint, because he's talking about marching with 100,000 of giants. And I thought it was a nice moment how Janos Slint's like, giants, this boy's tall. And then he looks over at the other guys and they're just like stone faced.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that there's a part of Westeros that has no idea that it'd be like, I don't know, us making fun of Canadians for believing in grizzly bears.
Okay.
You know, it's odd that just across the border, and I get we don't have a 700-foot wall, a tall wall between us and Canada. At least the Canadians haven't erected it yet to keep us crazy savage Americans from overrunning their polite borders. But it's just funny to me how out of touch King's Landing is.
Sure.
Anyway, the upshot is Master Aemon lets him off the hook because he believes that he's telling the truth. And I thought it was a good line about, you know, where did you get this magical talent? He goes, like, I grew up in King's Landing. Again,
yeah, that's funny.
You know, people I don't know if people remember this, but this guy is a Targaryen, brother of the Mad King Aerys. So he's seen some shit in his day.
Oh, yeah.
Going back down to King's Landing. We see the Lady Olenna with her granddaughter, Margaery Tyrell, dismissing all the necklaces. We know the wedding is in 2 weeks. Margaery makes a bad joke about Joffrey giving her a string of sparrow heads, which, what'd you think of her saying, you watch that, even here with me?
That's weird to me, because in this very location, they encourage Sansa to speak out about how much she hated Joffrey and what her problem was with him.
Right.
I think that what's happening here is she's just trying to get it into the head of Margaery. Don't ever say anything like that now that you're going to be his wife.
Right.
Like, no place is safe.
Right.
So I don't know. And maybe her her dealings with Varys, he's the eunuch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe her dealings with Varys have kind of enlightened her to just how many people are listening and where they might be.
Right.
Because we know he has a lot of people on the lookout. So
I also wonder if there's a little bit to this about, you know, she's fine with doing things that they have to do. Like getting Sansa to talk about Joffrey so they knew who they're dealing with is something they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something largely, you know, Sansa was the one committing treason. But to just do that as a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like she loves making jokes and she loves making jokes at others' expenses. But she's also, you can tell, a very serious minded woman, a very formidable woman,
mm-hmm.
who's been able to, I mean, last season we saw her dispatch without difficulty Varys, Tyrion, and fucking Tywin Lannister.
Yeah.
Although Tywin eventually got the better of her, better of her, it still is, you know, she is a powerful, formidable woman. Where is I going with this? Oh, so this scene seems to be set up so Brienne can come and talk to Margaery. Lady Olenna was delighted about, you know, just how fucking awesome Brienne is. And I got to meet Gwendolyn Christie a couple months ago and interview her at the Walker Stalker Con Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I'm a tall dude. I'm dating a tall woman. It's still my first reaction when I saw her coming up to me and she was wearing like 3-inch heels was like, shit, this is a tall. This is an impressive specimen of a woman.
Yeah, she's really tall.
And super intimidating, even dressed in, you know, casual street clothes.
Yeah.
When she's in her kind of like, you know, knight's uniform, it's just amazing.
Yeah, but you talk to her and she's super sweet.
Yeah, she's super sweet, super intelligent. I'll probably, at a good point sometime, talk about that. And I hope sometime during the airing of this that they'll release that interview on the video so we can share it. Because she had a lot of really good takes, especially on like feminism in Game of Thrones and her character's relationship with Jaime. Anyway, they discuss, Margaery and her discuss in private the Shadow Killer.
Yeah.
And Stannis and all that. What do you think was the purpose of this scene?
That is a really good question. I'm not quite sure where the Shadow Baby stuff factors in. But there was one thing I noticed about their conversation is when she says that I will avenge our king, when she's talking to Marjorie, they're talking about Renly because the Renly was killed by the Shadow Baby.
Right.
That seems weird to me that she would say this to Marjorie, who is about to be married to their actual king,
right,
Joffrey. I'm not sure why she would say that to her. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, the first thing, first of all, this is all stuff invented for the television show. This did not, you know, Brienne does make it to King's Landing, but it's much later and she has no contact with Marjorie.
Oh, okay.
So, my first thought is that, so this isn't book speculation, this is just me trying to extrapolate. My first thought is that Brienne truly loved Renly. Tragically, because Renly could never return that love.
Yeah, I think that was shown on screen fairly well.
Oh, yes. And so I think her forgetting herself was an indication of the loyalty that she still feels towards that man.
Okay.
And I also think the scene's purpose was to some... Now that we have Brienne, you know, going around King's Landing, a viewer might think, well, wait a second. Last time Marjorie saw Brienne, Brienne was fleeing the camp under suspicion amongst all her men of killing the king. She was the one accused, and Kat's like, we gotta get the fuck out of here or we're not gonna make it out alive.
Yeah.
So it might be just for us viewers that would have that opinion to be like, look, they've made up. That Brienne told her what she saw, Marjorie obviously believes her, and everything's smooth, so we don't have to worry about, you know, what's going to happen, or if Brienne's going to get in trouble, or what's going to happen with that. It might just be a way for them to shorthand address, because it was a very small scene.
Yeah.
And also allowed them to be walking in this garden, and we see the statue of Joffrey standing atop the wolf.
Oh, just insufferable. This statue.
But it bookends so nicely the next scene, because it goes completely into him in the exact same self-satisfied, smug pose, and he's in the Lord Commander of the Knight of the King's Guard's chambers, and they're planning his Jaime, his father, we know, is planning the security detail for the king, and Jaime seems like he starts off wanting to try to rein in a little bit on Joff's arrogance, reminding him, like, hey, you know, you owe a big debt to your queen, your future queen, and my father, and, you know, no small part, me leading your armies. And Joff's not having any of it. Joff feeds the people. Joff wins the armies. Joff does all this stuff.
Yeah.
And we talked in the preview cast, or the instant cast, about his completely being out of touch with his own achievements.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, like, you know, whether he believes it or not, and I think that statue of him on top of the direwolf, that harkens back to the conversation his mother and him had in season one, where he got bit by Nymeria, Arya's wolf, and, you know, he's all butthurt about it. And Cersei's like, when one day you're going to be the queen, king, and you can make history be whatever you want it to be.
Sure.
And he's now retconned that as him defeating the direwolf that Ned Stark beheaded. And he has, you know, destroyed Stannis at the Blackwater. And it's fascinating. And
it is.
The look on Jaime's face, well, let me ask you. Jaime looks distraught and various things throughout the scene. What is all going through his head?
Wow. before or after Joffrey opens the book?
Just the whole sequence. It goes, I mean...
Okay.
He's
trying to figure out why the hell, I think, at the beginning of this, Joffrey is pretending like he actually had something to do with all of this. Joffrey's standing there completely dismissing the security planning. Doesn't give a shit about his own wedding security.
Right.
He's staring up at his armor and his swords above the fireplace.
Right.
I think he very much does believe that he had a big part in saving King's Landing, even though he's got to know somewhere the events that happened don't bear that out.
Sure.
But I think Jaime is kind of observing him and looking and saying, how does this kid think that he had anything to do with that? Because I'm sure he's heard the stories now of how Tyrion worked and how Tywin came in at the last moment and actually saved the city.
Yeah, and I also think there's more than a little bit of, oh my God, that's my son. Okay. My son is a fucking cunt.
And how does he approach that? Because what are you going to do?
Right.
I mean, he's
supposed... apparently taken no interest in him.
Yeah.
In his upbringing or being a father at this point. Now he's at this conversion. He realized how vicious and stupid, like yeah. Tyrion said. You know, yeah. we've had a cruel king and we've had idiot kings, but we've never had a vicious idiot king before.
Yeah.
And it's horrifying. And then when he goes after Jaime, I think Jaime feels very vulnerable there too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Even though he's joking and he's saying, oh, I'm planning to, all I got to do is be better than the rest of them.
Right.
With my left hand. But I think that really got to him.
Do you think that the other Kingsguards, like Ser Meron Trant, seemed to be a little insolent with him too? Do you think they smell a little blood in the water?
Hmm. I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, he's like, hey, you know, I'm in the one guarding the king ever since you've been gone.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a little testy with him when he got reassigned, and then he seemed to be, you know, fully sucking on Joffrey's
Well,
dick.
I can understand that. I mean, if you're the guy who's running the show and... Sure. The king's son, or the not even the king's son, the hand of the king's son comes back, and all of a sudden you're demoted, and he takes your place. Yeah, that's got to be a little off-putting.
Anything else?
No.
Oh,
no.
I mean, there's also a lot of, if you want to go back and freeze frame on some of this, a lot of the stuff about Sir Arthur Dayne's Sword of the Morning, there was a lot of stuff in here written about the events that went down between Rhaegar and Lyanna and Martell and how they were massacred and all that. There's a lot of kind of history that we've been talking about, and it kind of ties it all in together. Mm-hmm. And a poor Jaime only has the half page of him basically being a betrayer.
I really didn't realize how young Jaime was when he was appointed to the Kingsguard.
Yeah, at the time, he's the youngest 16. One ever made. Yeah,
yeah,
ever minted.
I thought that might have meant like 25 or something. So all right. 16 is crazy.
So let's go back over the Narrow Sea, over to Dany and her camp, and we see Dario coming up to talk to Dany about a quote unquote matter of strategy, which is his strategy of getting into her pants. he gives her a bouquet in guise of teaching her about the land and its people.
He does. To be fair, he's got a solid point. You have to know the land and the people before you can rule them, right?
Yeah, because a bunch of freed slaves are going to completely turn their nose up at their savior because she doesn't know how to brew tea of the dusk rose.
Yeah. Well, if she brews them all poison tea, she won't have an army either. So,
yeah, because that's what a queen does. She spends all her time serving tea to her subjects.
Yeah, it makes me wonder.
And eating bread and honey, according to the nursery rhyme.
How does Dario know about all this stuff in this land? Is he from here?
In addition to being lieutenant of Sellsword Company, he's also a famous botanist and floral ranger.
That can't be true. you almost got me there. Okay, so he's just a well-traveled guy.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, he's you know, what's the equivalent to, like, a legionnaire, I guess. That's what a sellsword, like a you know, these mercenaries, and they travel the world and go to engagement after engagement, and he's just trying to impress upon her that, you know, she's the stranger from Westeros still, and, you know, he's got some, he's basically trying to, I guess, get her to subscribe to his charms.
Okay. I don't think he's doing a very good job.
No, speaking of not doing a very good job.
Yeah.
Dario 2.0, who I'm going to bequeath the title Dario Nyquilus, because every time I start thinking about talking, okay. I like the other crooked teeth, leering, insolent Dario better than this guy. This guy seems so far to be very uninspired. What's your take on him?
I wouldn't have guessed this. If you showed me Dario 1.0 and you said, there will be a guy who you like worse, who you like less than this guy, I would have said, no, that's not possible.
Yeah.
Because he was so creepy. Very brash. He was very...
He had this dangerous Euro trash vibe about him.
He did.
He was an extra in a James Bond movie
Or
like XXX. No, he's like the guy that the villain in XXX ran around with.
Pretty much, yeah. I could see him in maybe like a transporter flick.
There you he's a transporter villain. Yeah. In fact, wait a second. Did you know that? That's
know
why
what?
He got recast. He's
Oh, that's why I thought it. You told me that earlier.
Oh, okay,
because yeah.
I'm like, dude, if you came up with that, I just had a moment. No, he
that's
left
where it came from,
to
yeah.
participate. I'm not sure if he's starring in a reboot of it or if he's the stereotypical Eurotrash villain.
I think he is.
But he looks like it.
He does.
Totally. Like, that did not surprise me the least when I read that.
Yeah, but there was something about his connection with Daenerys that felt more real. And maybe it's just that this episode was one where the new Dario was getting chastised and thrown to the back of the marching line. Maybe we were not supposed to like him as much this episode, but I don't like the new one as much. He doesn't have any kind of edge to him. He's very bland.
I was having a conversation with Nina over at Project Fandom on our Facebook page, and she was saying that in book Dario and season 3 Dario, you get this feeling that this is a dangerous guy that, like, Danny's girlfriends are like, girl, stay away from this guy. He's no good for you.
For sure.
You don't want to take him around to your papa and all this other stuff. And this guy very much seems like someone you would take home to your mom.
Sure.
And he would, you know, have you back by 10 o'clock.
I think what they should have done is
curfew.
Cast Matthew McConaughey, because he's kind of got the look of the old guy.
Shit.
And you know he can act like the old guy and act it better.
He comes in, all right. Here's just, what's going to happen.
Naked with some bongos. Just put a wig on him. A long-ass wig, and you're good. And a big blue beard.
Just basically old Rust from True Detective.
With a can of beer in his hand.
Throw him in that armor and you're done. Done. Shit, he could have done that in between takes of True Detective.
For sure.
It's an HBO property, right?
Yeah.
On to less cool news. We see that Danny's company is rode upon to a mile marker pointing towards Marine. Problem is, it's got a child crucified to it. With her finger pointing the way.
Gruesome.
Jorah helpfully reminds us they're 163 miles away, and they offer, I think Barristan offers to, cut these down so she doesn't have to see it. She's like, nope, I want to see each face.
So how do they know that there's a child hanging from each of these posts? Do they have a scout 163 miles ahead saying, yeah, there's one on all these?
I think, okay, so this is...
Or a mile ahead and assuming there are two of them, so there must be all of them.
This is book knowledge, and I'm not sure if this got lost in editing or we are supposed to surmise this or what, but it's not a spoiler. Calm down, people, if you
Dragon
think it is.
Scouts.
In the books, they have ridden past dozens of these children already, but Danny doesn't ride to the front, and they've taken upon themselves to cut them down to spare her the horror of seeing it.
Oh.
And she finds out and is livid and is like, no, you will not. I will see each and every one of these children's face before we ride
it
past
them. It seems
like
they could have conveyed that very quickly and very easily.
That's what I'm saying. I wonder if it wasn't an editing thing.
It must
because,
have been.
Although I don't know how many people would see that scene and think, wait a second, how do they know there's going to be a kid on every mile?
I'm not calling bullshit on it.
No,
I'm just wondering.
You could also say, without using book knowledge, that if someone has, if there's a kid on mile marker 163, there's going to be several more. But yeah, he did say there's going to be one on each and every one.
Yeah, if they were scouting ahead to the second one, okay, I can see that. There are two of them. They're probably going to be on all
of them. Yeah, their outriders have already reported that there's...
Yeah.
So
I assume these guys are smart enough to have scouts.
You would think so.
I would hope so.
But I also like the touch that she wanted them to remove her slave collar before they bury her. That she's like wants her to be treated as a free woman in death.
She's
which is,
even freeing the dead.
Yep. So we go back to Westeros, where Sansa's in the pitiful Godswood that passes for a south of the Riverlands, Godswood. Uh-huh. I'm book nerding out. Never mind. Let's move on.
Okay.
Jaime and Brienne are seeing her and debating his oath to return the Stark daughters to safety or keep them safe. Jaime, we can tell, because some people had a problem. You know, judging by my feedback, and they're like, we don't like this. This is Jaime sliding back in his own ways. I don't see that because he's not debating with Brienne about, yeah, this is my oath, but he's more debating, like, what do you want me to do? I know she's not safe.
Where
King's
should
Landing.
I take her?
Exactly. Where do you think you should take her? If you wanted to...
I think she should go out to where Littlefinger is, because Littlefinger... I think would have the capability to at least see any attempt on her life coming and try to get her out of harm's way. Because I don't think Jamie has the knowledge that the Littlefinger has about this world.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think Tyrion does. I think Littlefinger, if you're looking for information, Littlefinger is the guy.
You could fit what Jamie knows about the world into a thimble, probably.
Okay. Into a hall of golden hands.
All right, any other thoughts? Because that's mildly interesting.
I thought there was one more thing in this scene. I'm not sure if I'm crazy here, but do you think that Jamie is hitting on Brienne at all? Because he's asking her, oh, are you sure you're not a Lannister? You could be with your hair, if not for the looks.
That's something I wondered a lot during this novel.
It felt like a slight bit of flirting going on.
I also thought the time where they were having that meeting in the, they were having the really intense discussion in the Harrenhal hot tubs.
Yeah,
and he was confessing, and he was disrespectful to her, and she like stood up, you know, full naked, and like I'm ready to throw down now, motherfucker.
Yep,
and he looked at her with a little bit of respect, but I thought that there might have been like a hint of a little bit of interest there.
I thought so too. Yeah, and I mean, he would have stood up to meet her, but you know,
yeah, he, you know, his DP engine wasn't fully healed and ready yet. No, that's something I've always wondered because, you know, I know she's always described as very homely in the books. She's much less so in the series. But again, Arya's always described as very homely in the books. But her father describes her favorably to her aunt Lyanna, who's one of the most beautiful women in the Seven Kingdoms. So I think maybe some of that's a commentary from George Martin about how women who don't fit in their gender roles are perceived by the men of Westeros.
Hmm. Okay.
That's just me. But when I see descriptions of Brienne, they're talking about how she's got, you know, high cheekbones and blonde hair and thick sensual lips, and she's got crooked teeth and deep blue eyes. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. She's hideous. She's obviously hideous. I mean, it doesn't sound like a hideous woman. Same thing when they describe Arya, and then it's like, oh, she's a horse face. You know, it's like they just described an attractive woman.
So it's like, called her a horse face.
Yeah, but you know, there again, they're the women that wear the pants and hold swords, and they're a threat to that patriarchy. Hmm. So,
yeah.
And I think, you know, Cersei is the opposite. Cersei is this goddess, this golden goddess, who's perfect in face and body, and the perfect compliment to Jaime, but he's starting to see that there's a lot that does. There's not much going on beyond that surface. Where Brienne's the exact opposite. She's a warrior like him, but has held on her honor intact despite all odds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's tons of depth to her. So do I see them as potentially? And this again isn't any book knowledge, because the story hasn't advanced much to that point yet, but I always thought that would be an interesting possibility.
I think so too.
And I could totally ship Brienne and Jaime.
Yeah, definitely. The more Jaime opens up and the more we see of Jaime, I feel like he's got way more in common with Brienne than Cersei.
On the other hand, I had a discussion with some people in Chicago that were kind of horrified by my take on that because they have such this, you know, mutual respect and, like, you know, comrade at arms and deep understanding of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want that to be reduced to just a romantic interest. But to me, that's a fucking awesome foundation for a relationship.
Yeah, it absolutely can be. And to see that evolve is okay with me. You know, I mean, if it evolves toward a romantic relationship, I'm okay with that.
All right, speaking of Sansa being in safety, I really like this next scene that they filmed it like a Sam Raimi old-school slasher flick, that she's being stalked in these woods, and there's a shadowy figure behind her, and she hears the footsteps, and she's getting panicked. But then it's just drunk Ser Dantos, did you recall him? Because this was a deep cut back into season 2, literally the first episode of season 2.
Yeah, I did a rewatch right before we started this, so I recalled that immediately.
And HBO did, on the preview, they did a lot of heavy lifting and helping people catch up to, you know, they had like a 2 minute, like, here's all the 3 second scenes you need to properly understand and jog your memory.
Yeah.
Because I bet there would be a lot of people saying, what the fuck, if they hadn't shown the scene of him, Joffrey trying to drown him in wine.
They don't do that on HBO Go.
I know.
It starts right up with the sword.
Right. I guess they're catering to binge watchers on that.
Sure.
Anyway, he wants to thank her because he might be a fool and he might be disgraced from a once powerful or rising house, now disgraced house. But he wants to thank her for saving his life by offering her the last heirloom he's got. A beautiful necklace that's been handed down from his mother and her mother and her mother before him. He wants her to take it, wear it, let her name, his name, have one last day in the sun before it disappears from the world, which, beautiful piece of writing and a really excellent acting job by some no-name dude I've ever heard, never heard of before.
Yeah. I wonder what the implication is here where Marjorie and, what is the older lady's name?
Olenna. The Queen of Thorns.
Yeah, they turned down all the necklaces in this episode, every single one.
All the necklaces.
And Sansa accepts the only one she's given. Mm. I wonder, like, I'm not smart enough, I guess, to understand the symbolism here, but it feels like there's something there. Can you give me any insight, or are you...
I can just show mild interest in anything you have to say.
Oh, God. Okay. All right.
I do think I was talking to...
Our listeners will clue me in on that.
Well, to a workmate who is not a book reader, and he wondered if this is going to tie into the Shay plot, that somehow that this guy's a cat's paw that is planting a stolen necklace on Sansa, that somehow going to, since Shay is her chief maiden, that it's going, that's actually, you know... I don't know. It's going to be some stolen goods. It's going to give Cersei the pretext to have Shay executed, or it's going to be leverage against Tyrion or something along that. What do you think of that theory?
That's as good a theory as any.
All right. Let's move on. We see the best part of the episode for me, Arya and the Hounds traveling roadshow. They've taken up the torch from Jaime and Brienne of last year. Arya wants a pony. we see them riding through this forest of death. It's just corpses and burning and disgusting things everywhere. She wonders why he doesn't have any money, why he didn't steal anything from King's Landing. And he's like, you know, I'm not a thief, which allows him to quote one of the other HBO all-time badasses, Omar Little, when he says, a man's got to have a code. Another callback here pretty soon, too. But that was one of them. And we find that his plan is to ride to the Vale to ransom her to her aunt, who's Lady Arya, which you'll recall has the 8-year-old son that's still not weaned off the sugar tit. The sight of her, of Sandor, which I'm going to call Colonel Sandor from now on because he does chickens right. The sight of him and Arya standing there in those bushes. With, like, there's a giant hole for his face to stick out of, and then 3 foot down, there's a giant hole for her face, and they're watching Polliver take a piss. It seemed like something so out of, like, Benny Hill or Monty Python, like a quintessential British comedy.
Yeah.
And I thought there was so much humor to this scene until things got fucking real, because there's the, you know, what the fuck's along me, and the farce of him being like, you can't go in there. We're not going in there. And then a guy walks out and sees this fucking hulking beast. And then they're committed, right?
And he's not going out there.
No. He's like, I was going to piss, but occupied. I'm going back in.
Yep.
So they walk in. They see the men assaulting a barmaid. We reintroduce the Polliver, who we last saw killing the Lomni, speaking of what the fuck a Lomni is, with running him through with Arya's needle. He recognizes Sander and goes to chat up the Hound, but he quickly grows tired of Polliver's bullshit. Polliver wants him to ride and go reaving with them, him and the rest of Gregor, his brother's men. But Sander says, fuck the king. And Arya's look is precious there. And then it just devolves into basically a Quentin Tarantino standoff.
Hell yeah.
What are your thoughts on this scene before we discuss it much further?
So I wanted to talk a little about the bookends in this scene.
Okay.
Because we have...
I can't tell you how the books end, Jim. I mean, you got to get it. This is only our first real episode, but you can't keep asking me how the books end, all right?
Sure, I'll stop that. So we start off with Arya just whining incessantly about everything, about not having a pony, about being hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you can whine about, she's whining about it. And it seems like over the course of this scene, there's a fundamental shift in the relationship to the point where she's got her own pony, something that the Hound said would never happen. Mm-hmm. Do you think I would give you your own horse?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he does at the end of this. And it's because I think she saves him or at least helps him out. I don't know if she necessarily saved his life. But there's a fundamental shift. And it feels like they've been moving very, very slowly. And maybe like they would take a step forward and then a step back mm-hmm. in these previous seasons. I'm hoping this is an actual step forward. And that maybe by the time that they arrive... at the breastfeeding queen, they will.
She's not the god of tits, but she's the queen of tits and whiners.
Awesome. I'm hoping there will be a very different relationship that they have once they arrive, maybe to the point where he won't even want to ransom her anymore.
All right.
It feels like it's headed there, and I'm okay with that.
She's got a horse and a sword, so she's certainly, yeah. He's got to take her serious on some level at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, the dialogue in the scene, you know, where the Hound's says, "Hey, bring me one of them chickens." And then Polliver's like, "You don't understand the situation, friend." He's like, "I get it. You're a talker. Listening to talkers makes me thirsty." And he grabs the dude's drink and just drinks it in one gulp. And he's just keeping eye contact with him the whole time.
Yeah.
It's so badass.
Not only does he want the chickens, but now he's drank your beer.
And then the second allusion to a former HBO badass from Deadwood season one, Wild Bill, when Polliver is saying, "You don't understand what's going on here." He goes, "I understand if you don't shut your, or if any more words come pouring out of your cunt mouth," which is a direct quote, "I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room." That's what the... a Wild Bill said to somebody he was gambling with.
Okay.
It's like, "Your mouth looks like a cunt. It's just like an open..." we debated about the foulest language on a TV show before. I think it was during our Walking Dead wrap-up cast.
Mm-hmm.
Deadwood takes the cake.
Okay.
Never been more swears per minute and more colorful swears than on Deadwood.
I've never seen it.
We need to watch it. I think it's the 15th anniversary or maybe the 10th sure. anniversary.
It's on Go, so I'll check it out.
Yeah, the Natter cast, the boys have been watching it.
I was going to say maybe we could do a cast on it. It's only like, three seasons?
Three, maybe, because I never finished it. I got through season one.
Okay.
And then...
too much foul language for you.
Yes, I was offended. Anyway, tables get flipped. The Hound goes into beast mode. I love the fight choreography.
Yeah.
And whichever Double D directed this, I think it was David. Maybe it was Dan. I can't recall. Whichever half of the Double D's that directed this shows a lot of understanding how you film action, because it was gritty. It wasn't too much shaky cam. You got a clear understanding of where it's going. Yeah. They somehow made... the fact that there was multiple people rushing the Hound that multiple different directions, believable, and like, you know, even a beast like Sandor, it's not like that fight was easy for him to win.
Yeah.
And how did they do the stop stabbing yourself scene where he makes that guy stab himself in the head? Because that looked so fucking real.
I assume that sword is just CGI, yeah.
But they synchronize the wounds on the guy's face.
They do. And the way they've kind of flipped the camera down along with his head.
Yeah.
And I think that helps to sell the effect a lot.
And for a first-time director, the dynamic camera work where we follow like the innkeeper and his daughter up a staircase into the loft, and that gives us an interesting new vantage point of the action. Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. They show that the Hound sees that as well.
Right.
Like he looks up as a guy is coming at him with a sword from below.
Right.
And he's good enough to block that, but also notice his surroundings.
So, anyway, there's a lot of really hilarious Reddit memes on this. There was the Los Polos Morgulis. there was another one where it showed a pile of Lannister dead bodies, and it said, "Winner, winner, chicken dinner."
Okay, you're going to have to explain this Morghulis thing to me.
Because
I don't know what this is.
So Morghulis is what the faceless man told Arya when he left her and gave her that iron coin.
Uh-huh.
Valor Morghulis is Valyrian for all men must die.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
So Los Polos would be the chicken must die, I guess.
Okay.
But it's a, you know, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones mashup.
Obviously.
So the climax of the scene is Arya's kind of hanging out in the wings. The whole time I'm like, oh my God, is she going to get in on this? Is she going to get in on this? When it looks like the Polliver might get the jump on the Hound, she smashes a bowl on someone's head, runs him through with his own longsword, hamstrings Polliver with said longsword, reclaims Needle, and then in an echoing of her experience with him killing Lomni, asks him if your legs are okay, am I going to have to carry you? And then brutally stabs him right in the throat and lets him choke to death on his own blood.
Yeah.
Okay, let's just talk about this and how much enjoyment she got.
Okay.
How do you feel about this aspect of the scene? Because I saw a lot of reviewers and a lot of feedback where people are like, you know, it's exciting, but it's also heartbreaking that Arya is, you know, becoming this hard, psychopathic killer. What's your take on this? And I'll tell you
more. I think you can certainly view it that way. And I guess I tend to when I see children killing and the circumstances driving them to killing, which has happened in a couple shows that I watch. I think that's a big part of it, but I know that you have a slightly different opinion on it. So why don't you... I don't want to steal your opinion here because I know what it is.
My shit is totally unbothered by Arya being this killer.
Why?
This is a woman who saw her father beheaded. It's a woman who's carrying a sword before all this happened anyway.
Sure.
She then had to flee King's Landing. Almost everyone she befriends is either dies or dies to save her. She's been mentored by a series of killers. Cyril Pharrell, Jaqen H'ghar, now the Hound. And her family gets the shit end of all possible sticks.
Yeah.
I am not going to be troubled by taking enjoyment from watching this little girl kick ass.
And your opinion of it is that it's more just about the revenge. It's not her becoming psychotic. It's just her getting her justified revenge.
Yeah, I don't get the idea that she's not a morally... I mean, I don't think that she is lacking in empathy here. In fact, I think it's because of her empathy and her sense of justice that she is doing this.
Yeah, I think that's a fair read.
I mean, I mean, to me, this is the same as Khal Drogo dumping a cauldron of gold on fools what need it. I mean, she repaid Polliver in literally his own coin.
Yeah.
For what he did. And this guy is one of the mountain's chief men. He was basically complaining about all the torture he had to do because it wasn't fun for him anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think that this is me showing how fucked up I am, but I don't know that killing a person like that is, you know, going to give one nightmares and make a person psychotic.
Sure.
I mean, I know this when you fight a monster or, you know, when you fight a monster, you take care not to become one, but still. When I see Arya become a monster, maybe I'll start worrying about that. But
sure. Oh, you said when? That must be a book spoiler.
What? No.
No. I'm kidding.
Stop starting shit, Jim.
So I do want to say that this kill right before, where she smashes a pot on the guy's head and runs him through with his longsword, that felt like it was real because the way she like tries to heft this long sword up.
And it's not easy
and
running
just, like,
a person
slowly,
through. Yeah.
Like, she's got to use all her effort to just get this into this guy's rib cage.
Yep.
That felt really real to me.
So then after that, we see Colonel Sander riding out with his bucket of chicken. Arya's got her white pony.
How many chickens were in those saddlebags?
All the chickens.
All of the chickens?
All the chickens, Jim.
Good idea.
And every fucking chicken in that room. And the end music we play out once again, thanks for Rob S for pointing this out, but they play the Stark theme backed up by the militant drums of the Game of Thrones theme, and it eventually just turns into the Game of Thrones theme.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we play the name game, Jim?
Okay, sure.
Two swords. What's the meaning? What's the meaning? Go. I got five bullet points here.
Oh, Jesus. I have maybe two. Obviously, the two swords that are created from...
The two Valyrian steel swords.
The old Stark sword.
Yep.
Which has a name that I don't know.
Ice.
Just ice?
Ice. Okay. Ice.
Fitting
maybe.
Where they're from. Okay.
Yeah, two.
That's one.
That's one.
Oh, you want me to go... Yeah. I thought we were going to trade.
Hell no.
The other one is the sword that Jaime gets... Actually, I can do three here, maybe. The sword that Jaime gets and Needle. Both of these are kind of new swords that are given, I guess, back to people this episode. Because Jaime now has a sword again.
All right.
Which is, I'm sure, nice for him. And she's got Needle back.
And I'll throw in one on top of that.
Needle back, not Nickelback.
That we saw the Starks lost a sword in Ice, but the Starks regained a sword in the form of Needle.
They did.
So one is the death knell for the past, and one might be a hopeful note for the future.
And if you want to go
although
talk
if you think
about...
this story has a happy ending, you haven't been paying attention.
If you want to talk about a little bit of symbolism, and maybe the changing nature of the Hound and Arya's relationship, you could call them two swords now, riding together toward whatever their destination ends up being.
Mm-hmm. I got two more. One is there's the two long swords that the Lannister soldiers had in a brothel that were inefficient against the Martell dagger.
Mm, yeah.
And also the two swords held by Dario and Grey Worm in their bet to win Dany's favor.
Yeah, I suppose that should have been more obvious to me.
Well, but it's lots of two-sword imagery in the two-sword title. Yeah. We'll see how that comes in the play next week. Or this weekend, rather. That's all I got for the episode. What do you got? And then we'll get into some light pimping and some feedback because we're running long, I know.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Thanks to Dylan J for giving us some suggestions for pimping. But just want to let everybody know that Amazon currently has all five of the paperbacks sold in a bundle for $27. Free shipping with Prime. That's about $5 a book shipped to your door. And you can get caught up with all the Song of Ice and Fire there is. You can also get the same bundle on Kindle for $19.99, although I would recommend buying them individually on Kindle because I actually started with the compendium and I found it very hard to keep track of where I was in just this giant, you know, if I wanted to flip
so
back.
So it's one volume, one book?
It's one thing on Kindle.
Wow.
And it's like, you can read for 3 days and the progress meter doesn't even roll over a percent.
Oh, geez.
The individual books are $4.99 a piece. So I think it's, you know, you're spending $5 more, but I just found it a lot easier to wield.
Yeah, get them like once a month or something, once a week, whatever.
Right, because the other thing is like, you know, sometimes I'd want to refer back to a chapter, so I'd hit go to the table of contents and then want, you know, to find the previous Arya chapter. Yeah. Well, when you do that on the compendium, you jump back to a whole freaking beginning and, you know, I guess if you just read and you never jump back or forth, then you'll be fine, but that's my personal recommendation. If you're going to buy it, use our Amazon affiliate link, amazon.baldmove.com. Because then we'll get a teeny tiny cut of those Amazon profits and we can use them to fund the liquor and bandwidth we need to forge these podcasts ourselves.
Yeah, and do new shows. Aren't we covering Fargo?
Fargo's coming out this week. We'll have some podcasts on that. I'm not sure when we'll be releasing that, but we'll have it out. Well, you can also... do our Subbable.com/baldmove, SUBBABLE. It's a free subscription service that allows you to subscribe to our content, directly contribute to the production of our podcasts, and also earn cool rewards at the same time. And you can go there, Subbable.com/baldmove, for the full pitch. Go to baldmove.com. I mean, I got all this linked to every show in the show notes, so you can see all the ways you can support us, including you know, giving us reviews on iTunes and all of your feedback options.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I have a huge stack of feedback to go through.
Oh, geez. We're running real long.
I know we're running real long, so I'm going to be as quick as I can. Sheen wants to know, quick question, is the Red Viper a bisexual in the books? Because I didn't remember that.
Hmm. Who's the Red Viper?
The Red Viper is another nickname for Prince Oberon.
Oh, book spoilers. Not mentioned in the show.
This is his nickname, man. Okay. The Red Viper.
No spoilers there.
Anyway, so I would say that it's as strongly hinted in the books that he's bisexual as it is hinted that Loras is gay, which is, you definitely get that flavor, but it doesn't smack you in the face like the show does.
Yeah.
So that would be my answer for that. Levi R. says, I feel for the Lannister boys, Joffrey and Tywin notwithstanding. Events have placed both Tyrion and Jaime in precarious positions. What I'd really like to see is both of them rise together above the pettiness of their sister and father.
Oh.
I feel like they're both well-placed men of good character, but as you alluded to in the preview cast, Jaime's kind of goodness is not rewarded in this world, and Tyrion has trouble with people taking him serious because of a statue. How touching would it be to see them find a way to work together to usurp control from Tywin?
That would be sweet.
He also says, and Arya, touching on the point we made at the end, he says, oh boy, Arya, I never thought I'd be so delighted to see a young girl slip a blade into a man's throat, but I loved, capital letters, that scene. The fact that he didn't even know who she was until the last second, that was cold.
Yeah.
But he did make the connection at the end. Ice cold. How she slowly slipped a blade in, the fact that she didn't kill him, but she watched him choke on his own blood. This thing is going to make her well-adjusted, but I do think it was very therapeutic for her. Most of her family has been murdered, her father's head taken before her own eyes. She needs something tangible, an outlet for all that pain. Good for her. I'm right there with you, Levi. Anything to add before we move on? Kimberly M says, I have to agree with our Aaron about the, or Aaron. Whoops. My secret is out. Oh, shit. I have to agree with Aaron's take about the recasting of Dario as a lady. Wink. Because I mentioned a preview cast, like I can't speak as a lady. But
oh, for some reason I was thinking recast him as a lady. What? Why would you do that?
Dario Nyquilis, the lady Dario. The magnetism is not there at the recast. Mm-hmm. I was also surprised that they did not try to get an actor who looked anything similar to the original actor.
Yep.
Yeah, that
Matthew like, McConaughey. I'm telling you.
All right. Hola, Kimo Sabe. I felt the attraction between Danny and Dario was not there in the episode as it was last season. Hoping that will change, but I won't hold my breath. I will back away a little bit in saying that the Double D's are not fucking idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And they spend money lavishly on this show. And I know this guy's a very accomplished actor from other series.
Huh.
So maybe we just caught him in a bad time. That this, yeah. That, you know, that this Dario doing the field guide to Essos... botany is from the books.
Okay.
And so maybe that's not the best showcase for his badass potential or his reckless, sure, dangerous potential. Janine S, who you might remember from previous seasons as the Dragon Walker. Just a couple of thoughts on the first episode on Joffrey's invincibility. Remember in season one after he's mauled by Nymeria, Cersei was telling him that he could make reality anything he wanted and could have a history say anything. And now, obviously, he's taken that to heart. Indeed. On Oberon Martell, oh, yeah, I like him already. He's much more interesting even than in the books, and he's fairly interesting there. I feel like even though we've been long on this cast, I can't say enough about how great I thought his casting was and his performance. I'm so ridiculously excited that this guy is playing this character.
Who are we talking about? Grey Worm?
No, Oberon.
Oh, yeah, no, he was really good.
Alan Sepinwall said he's got this vintage Ricardo Montalban... like Wrath of Khan vibe to him, which I think he does have that dangerous, oily, sophisticated swagger to him.
Sure. I can buy that.
She also says in Dario, okay, in the books, he's the Tairashi, I think, and they have a custom to change your hair color and dress routinely.
Is this spoiler alert? Or
nah, it's supporting detail. Maybe this is just a Tairashi fashion change. A little less creepy Dario's fine with me, as I couldn't connect with him last season. Yeah, I mean, in the books, he's got purple hair and a blue forked beard and gold teeth. So
connect with that.
Yeah. And strangely enough, there's fuckers hanging out on the Song of Ice and Fire Reddit who wanted the show to do that Dario.
Oh, of course. Of course. They're the hardcore book fans. And have been for 20 years.
This guy shows up looking like Grimace from Ronald McDonald Land.
Yeah.
And I get it, in your head it looks cool, but that's not going to look cool in the real world. It's going to look like a psychedelic version of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, the majority of the audience will not connect with that.
Jeffrey, the self-titled Sayer of the Law, says, I love the way the show announced what I assume will be an important theme for the season. The episode is bookended by Tywin melting down the Stark Greatsword ice and Arya reclaiming her own blade needle. In light of the Hound's words with the Lannister men at the end, Tywin would be well advised to hold off on counting his chickens just yet.
Because they could all be eaten by the end of this next episode.
Don't catch your chickens before Colonel Sander eats them all. Number two, Jamie. His painful journey continues, encountering rejection by father, son, and nephew, and sister lover alike. Whether Cersei rejected Jamie's advances because she feels vulnerable now that their relationship is no longer secret, or because she realized from her cavorting with Lancel that any Lannister will serve her needs, is almost beside the point in light of her cold treatment. I don't see Jamie reacting with favor if Cersei does what we think she's going to do to Shay, which I'm guessing may be the catalyst to a Lannister showdown of sorts with Tyrion and Jaime taking sides against the others.
God, that'd be sweet. They're my two favorite Lannisters by far. They're the only Lannisters I'm rooting for in any capacity. It makes me wonder, though, is Jaime being spurned by all of the rest of his family kind of driving him toward Brienne?
Man, you are shipping Brienne harder than I've ever seen you ship anybody anything in your life.
I'm not necessarily saying romantically.
Jamie
I'm just
and Brienne
saying...
is your Don and Peggy.
Yeah. I'm just saying, when he doesn't have these other support means around him with his family, maybe that's where he turns. And not necessarily in a romantic relationship, but...
Want to plunder her sapphire. If...
Oh, Jesus.
Josh from Fort Collins, Colorado says, Oberyn had a good character establishing moment. I'll say this for new characters, though they sometimes don't pan out, they're pretty good at least when it comes to introducing them for the first time. Stannis, the Manus, the Mountain, the Brotherhood, Dario, Oberyn, etc. all received memorable openings or early scenes that told you quite a lot about them. The Thins, too, though the jury's still out about the Magnar's performance. I don't think I mentioned this, but the head Thin in the book is called the Magnar.
Oh, okay.
Which is like the old tongue for Lord.
All right.
And I don't know if that's the guy's official name or title in the series, but that's what people have been calling him. Anyone who dwarfs Tormund Giantsbane, though, gets my attention. He did. He was a big dude. Big crow eater.
Although I didn't think that the other guy was very big. He looked about as tall as Ygritte. And
that's true.
Honestly.
I don't know if that was an uneven terrain or not, but yeah, there's a couple scenes where they seem to be about a height, and I don't think that Rose is a giant herself. It was good to see a couple old familiar faces back at the wall. Alistair Thorne looked huge next to Aemon and Slint, and I don't think he realized that Owen Teal's a pretty big guy, even though he was a head taller than Jon Snow in season one. That's the actor. Fitting for a master at arms, another strong scene that I loved was the moment where Slint laughs at Jon's mention of giants, why Thorne and Aemon don't even flinch. I think I'm going to enjoy the Castle Black scenes this year. Me too, Josh. And that ending, it's equal parts a cathartic victory and an unsettling transformation. Arya's echoing of Polyvore's words back to him in that emotionless, not quite natural tone she used with the Frey soldiers in last season's finale is eerie. On one hand, you're happy that something good happened to a Stark, that she's riding off with a sword back and a horrible man dead, but on the other, you're aware that this world is doing to Arya. As you noted in Instant Cast, we get that final shot of her and a hound riding triumphantly, yet forward into a burning, ravaged countryside. It's a sad reminder of what Arya and so many of Westeros have had to suffer, and an ominous portrait of, or portent of what the future has in store for her.
Mm-hmm.
So he's from a little column A, column B school of thought about her quote-unquote triumph at the end.
Yeah.
Anything to mention before I move on?
Nope.
Shane F. said, Aaron has often acted annoyed about how often this show includes the reigns of Castamere. I think that last season the show had to impress that song on the audience as often as possible so that during the last, or the Red Wedding, the viewer would recognize the song as fast as the characters and maybe even a touch before. That aside, I love the idea that opening credits is the song for the Starks. Of course, glad you love that idea, but I'm dead wrong. Looking forward to the new season. I'll miss Mad Brew's theories, strong opinions, and especially his affection for Arya. I love to listen to him rant about how epic she was in the final scene of the opener, but I already know that I enjoy the chemistry between Aaron and Jim. He's thanks for all efforts, so thank you for that. Go to madbrewlabs.com if you want. You can chat him up and see what he thought if he's watching it live. I'm not sure if he is. But yeah, by all means, reach out to him. Dylan J said, great first episode. I'm really interested in our new Dornish friends. In the preview cast, you mentioned a little bit of the backstory and bad blood. I know that Aaron can't say much, but how long do you think it will take before Prince Aladdin starts wreaking havoc in King's Landing? And who will his first victim be? Okay, it will take him approximately 5 minutes of screen time, and his first victim will be a Lannister wrist. That man will never jerk off a full range of motion again. It's tragic. All these Dornish men that rode in to meet Tyrion, where do they fit in? I mentioned in the preview or the instant cast how kind of, you know, Oberon's a one-man wrecking machine, but he did have... God only knows how many Dornishmen coming with them. Where do you see them fitting in there, Jim?
Well, they didn't do a very good job, in my opinion, of introducing those other people. As good of an introduction as Oberyn got, the other people were glossed over largely. So I couldn't tell how many people were with him. I couldn't tell what kind of people. Was he bringing warriors? Was he bringing lords and ladies? Like, it was hard to tell in that scene. So... if he brought kind of a bunch of gruff dudes with him, maybe shit's going to go bad soon. I don't know. If he brought a bunch of his wives and daughters, maybe shit's not going to go bad.
Well, it's Westeros. Predicting that shit's going to go bad is usually
pretty safe bet.
Usually that's a pretty safe bet. Randy H has her last non-spoiler email. He says, what's up with the necklaces? I'm wondering if these three separate events will eventually come together, perhaps with fatal consequences for Shay. The Lannister maid is shown spying on her as she leaves Sansa and Tyrion's quarters and then reports it to Cersei. Lady Olenna sends her girls on a quest for the best necklace in King's Landing for Margaery to wear at the wedding. And Ser Dantos surprises Sansa and out of the blue offers her his mother's necklace. I won't be surprised if the fool's necklace is reported as stolen, and when it ends up in Sansa's possession somehow, the facts are twisted to blame Shay for it. Bum, bum, bum.
I think maybe we talked about that earlier.
Mild interest. yeah, my buddy Will that I used to work with has the similar theory.
Okay.
And that awkward silence says that we're at the end of our main cast proper.
Oh, good. That was a really long cast. So
it is. It is. I hope it was comprehensive for people. And you can send us email at GameOfThrones@baldmove.com if you'd like. I almost said TNW.
No.
GameOfThrones@baldmove.com if you'd like to send us some more feedback. And also, you can always follow us on Facebook.com/baldmove and Jim over on Twitter @baldmove. And unless you have anything else to say, we'll kick it to spoilers, where the book people should just stay the hell out.
No, the non-book people.
Sorry, the non-book people should stay the hell out. The book people should come the hell in.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. That's it. I got nothing.
All right. See you this weekend for a new episode. And until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
We're out. Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn, Payne, and Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm bound. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar Dohaeris, all men must serve. See as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar Morghulis, all men must die. All right. Welcome to the exclusive book reader only and adventuresome television watchers spoiler section. If you have not read all five of the current books up through Dance with Dragons, I highly encourage you to shut off your podcast now. I can't stop you, of course. I get emails on a weekly basis saying, man, I wish I had listened to your warnings and I didn't, and now I'm disappointed, and I don't want that to be you. But again, there's some people like myself. I'm kind of spoiler agnostic. I think if something's done well, it's enjoyable regardless of whether you know it's coming. However, I would hate for you to be spoiled in the context of a podcast. You know, it's one thing if you spoil yourself for a television show, reading the books, or vice versa, but you got some dumbass like me just giving it to you straight, that could be a problem. Anyway, you've had the music. You've had me droning on for a minute. Let's get right to the spoilers. A couple things no one touched on in email, but I wanted to point out for the book readers is I thought it was really clever, Tyrion's second son reference, when he was commiserating with Oberon as being the second son. He called him a fellow second son. Of course, Dance with Dragons, he becomes an official second son, part of the second son sellswords company. I thought that was clever. I also thought, I'm not sure if they've ever made a reference to Pigeon Pie before, but one of the many things that Shay was trying to tempt Sansa with to eat was pigeon pie. And, of course, you know, pigeon pie famously comes into play with when it's served to the Boltons and Freys. I'm not going to go. I do try to protect the venturesome fans a little bit, not just tell, you know, big plot lines. But you know what I'm talking about. And finally, what do we make of the Thins? You know, in the books, the Thins are the more civilized branch of the Wildlings. They wear copper armor. They have more advanced weaponry. They have a social structure similar to the Northern Lords, rather. You know, they have a lot of the same customs. They're, you know, very similar culture to the First Men, very similar culture to the Northmen in general. And here they're played as bloodthirsty cannibals.
it's not a big problem so far. It was very cool and menacing. But it, you know, the books, I felt like as we got to know the wildlings, that they're more like, hey, just like us. And in a television show, some of them at least are bloodthirsty cannibals. We'll see what they end up doing with that. Maybe they'll do something interesting with it. But I thought it was interesting. And if you'd like to discuss it, send an email to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. I try to read as much last week email as I can until it gets the crush of, you know, new show feedback prevents me from doing that. But if any of that is interesting, go ahead and send us an email. There were a couple fans that did send us some spoiler commentary. First up, Nevin said, Aaron, you said something caught my attention. Drogon snapped at Dany. You said, how is she supposed to control them when it comes time for her to take her throne? I came up with this, and this is only if they cross paths sometimes during the story. What if at some point Dany crosses paths with Bran, and with Bran being a warg, maybe his skills will be strong enough to control the dragons for Dany? It's really the only way I see her riding it. That's a solid theory. In fact, if you follow the tinfoil theories on Reddit and Westeros.org, some other places, you'll find them talking about the dragon must have three heads. We talked a little bit about that in the tinfoil section last week, and I think it's going to be a future topic, what the identity of those three dragon heads might be. I don't think they've actually made it a point in the show that, you know, they haven't really talked much about these prophecies, and they've kind of soft-pedaled all the prophecies. It might just be because there's no need to bring it up in season one if it's not going to come into play until season five, so they can always inject that later, just like Ser Dontas. We'd kind of written him off, right? Boom, he comes back at the beginning of season four. So they can make that happen. But one of the identities of the three heads, people say, is Bran literally warged into a dragon, which would be cool as hell, and might kind of wrap your theory in with this third head theory. So moving on to Sheem. Says, when Sansa escapes, how is her marriage to Tyrion annulled in the books? I know Littlefinger has plans to marry her off. They don't really annul her marriage yet, although the path forward to that seems pretty clear. Number one, they reveal Sansa Stark. Number two, she never consummated a marriage. That's a fact. I don't know if it'll be common knowledge, but she can just, I mean, it'll work for Marjorie, right? Never slept with the guy, marriage null and void. Second, depending on how all this stuff works out, and Littlefinger might be playing all these angles, maybe Stannis, as the king, has the right, I believe, to annul marriages. If he wins the war and sits the Iron Throne, or some other ally of Littlefinger or the Stark sits the Iron Throne, they could annul the marriage or lean on the High Septon to annul the marriage as well. So these things can be done. I think the key fact is that it never was consummated. So the marriage can easily be legally set aside. And I don't see that as being a big problem moving forward for those two, or for Sansa anyway. Tyler S. says, good call on the Hound meeting Polliver this episode. The only wrench was the Hound not getting injured. I'm hoping they don't spend the whole season chilling near the Eyrie, but it's possible now. Or maybe they're going to have Arya kill the Hound. She seems to have a taste for killing now, and last season, she made that threat about putting a sword through his eye and out the back of his skull. I watched the scene a bunch of times because it's cool, and also because of Tyler's message here. I think that you can see the Hound get slashed in the back at one point. And he doesn't make much of his injury. In the book, he kind of played off it as nothing until it got infected and became a problem. But they laid the foundation there for, if you're watching, you can see him take a hit, maybe even two hits. And if in a couple episodes goes by, he reveals that he's got this wound that's infected. I don't see any reason why that can't play out just like it is in the book. Having said that, my God, the chemistry between the Hound and Arya is fantastic. I would not mind seeing more of this. So if they stretch this out and do the whole season until they part ways somehow, I'm cool with that too. Tyler continues, it's interesting that they reintroduced Sir Dantos. I'm wondering if the Double Ds regret not having him as a part of the subterfuge with Littlefinger from the beginning, because now it seems like they still want a big reveal that Littlefinger's behind it all, even though we pretty much know. I don't know, because my take on the non-book readers that I've talked to this week is they have no fucking clue that this necklace is going to be integral to the plot. And it's still going to be, yeah, it's still going to be pretty breathless when we get to the Purple Wedding and it is deployed. And if Littlefinger's at the end of that, it's still going to be pretty shocking for a book reader. I'm delighted that they brought that little part of Sir Dantos back. And I think for as big a gap in time as it's been two full seasons since we've seen him. I thought, again, with the intro, did a lot of heavy lifting and set it up nicely so the book readers and the show readers like, oh, yeah, I know who this guy is. Everybody, I didn't talk to anybody yet that didn't know who he was. But none of the non-book readers have any clue that that necklace is going to be anything. So I think it's really cool the way they did that. And I think it's going to be epic. It's going to be mind-blowing along the lines of the Red Wedding, especially since if it happens next episode, nobody's prepared for shit that big to happen in the second episode. It'll be a big statement by the Double Ds. He continues, Tyler does, I wonder if Jaime's early arrival to King's Landing will have any implications beyond some extra scenes between him and Joffrey or Tyrion. I don't know. I really don't know. I think that I love seeing him and Brienne. I love seeing Brienne reminding him of his obligations to the Starks. I think that that's going to, obviously Sansa's going to go missing over the next two or three episodes. And Jaime's all but admitted that he still feels kind of indebted to making sure he's safe. And I think that's going to be the impetus for him to bequeath unto her than his new Valyrian blade and send her off on her quest. I also think that with Tyrion being otherwise occupied and engaged, that Pod will get to go along with her, which is cool, because I thought in the book that those two had a lot of common cause and chemistry, and I'd like to see those two actors play off each other. Finally, said, totally right about the wedding being next episode. Looks like it's going to be pretty epic. Agreed. You called that right. I was very skeptical that they'd get around to it that early, but according to the previews and from the show descriptions and even the titles, I think that we're right on track. Josh in Fort Collins, Colorado says, the first episode introduced one or two elements that we might not have expected and could affect where some readers and viewers had guessed what might occur and when. Sir Dantos returned, for example, something I didn't realize was happening until recently. I'm hoping he'll have something of a presence at the Purple Wedding next week, likely in his capacity as a fool. I'm assuming they brought him back to help Sansa with her escape. I'd imagine the wedding will take up much of the next episode with Sansa fleeing and meeting up with Littlefinger in episode 3. I do wonder how much of Sansa's story will be getting this season. If they put everything, journeying to the Fingers, spending time here before moving to the Eyrie. Or is that Eyrie? Or Ire? I have no idea how to pronounce the word that is literally an eagle's nest. If someone wants to correct my dumbass, please do so. Anyway, they can probably pull it off. From the trailers I saw, it looks like she's going to make it at least to the Fingers, if not to the Eyrie, because there's a picture of her kind of laying, and it looks like it's a cold room, because I think I saw her breath form, but she's laying in a very narrow, something like you would expect a bastard daughter to be laying on, in some kind of very lonely, dark room. So I think we will see her go there by the end of the season. If it takes three episodes to get Gendry from the Riverlands to Dragonstone, then they can make Sansa's story last in the last episode. Sure, yeah. And in the season where the book ended with Lyza's death, man, if you look at the way this end of the season is stacked up as far as things happening, I can kind of see them punting that into next season as an early shocker. But they might just be piling on the awesome here. I don't know. And I also don't know how far into Feast and Dance they're willing to go. Obviously, they're going a lot deeper than any of us thought, and to the point where I wonder, they said that this thing's going to be over in 7-8 seasons. This is at season 4. If they kick off next season and finish completely Dance with Dragons, that only leaves they could do Winds of Winter in one and Dream of Spring in the other, and that'd be seven seasons, and I think Martin's fucked in that scenario. I kind of think he's fucked even if it's eight seasons as far as getting a Dream of Spring out, but you know, that's fodder for another day. I know that you and other listeners speculated that Tywin might die as early as episode 7 or 8, but I don't see it happening until 9 or 10, if only because Storm ended with so many great moments for their respective characters. I heard that 9 is going to be the battle at the wall almost exclusively. So I don't see them putting it off until 10, because that would be 6 episodes, or maybe even 7 episodes. Because likely it's Tyrion's trials episode 3, at most 4. Maybe the trial of combat is episode 4. That's like 6 episodes of him just languishing in jail. And I just don't see that happening, that being interesting. Especially when you've got the battle at the wall for a big send-off at 9. But we'll see. Clearly, they're moving into Feast to dance for some storylines. I'm assuming that that's Braavos we saw in the trailer with the giant statue. So Arya's going to get there this season. I might slow your roll on that, because if you look at that trailer carefully, you can see that there's a flag, a banner flying off that ship, and it is the Flaming Heart with the stag. A lot of people speculating that's actually going to be Stannis, or maybe Davos in his name, going to the Iron Bank to try to curry favor with him, which is going to set up the plot line where eventually the Iron Bank comes to the wall and offers to support him. Maybe next season. But I don't think we're going to get to Arya and Braavos just yet. Or if it does, it might be the very last thing that happens this season. Could be wrong, though. I'm wondering where Dany's story might stop by the time we finish the season. We've seen the I Will Rule moment already, and what looks like Drogon killing some poor sap. Finding out he killed some kid could be a major moment for Dany, but could we end the story there? That's harder to say. That would be an interesting place to end it. An interview with the Double D said episode 10 is the most expensive episode that they've ever filmed as far as cost per second. And they previously said that about episode 9, the Battle at the Wall. That implies like a CGI extravaganza. And some people are saying that could either be Bran having a green seer dream about the future and all this other stuff. So a lot of people speculating that's where we see the dragon over King's Landing, because that clearly is not going to happen yet. It could also be the dragons busting out and rampaging through Meereen. That would be something that would cost a lot of money to render. So we'll just see. The show's been light on special effects so far, and they said they saved a lot of budget from last season to do this season. So we'll see where they get into. I think what's most interesting, though, is where Jon might be at the end. From what I've read, it looks like the episode's 9 major event is going to be the Battle at the Wall at the arrival of Stannis. If that's the case, it looks like the rescue would be a good episode ender, as it reflects the end of Blackwater. That seems like it would leave a lot for the final episode of the season. If Jon still needs to be elected, if the Watch is going to deal with Stannis, I wonder if much of the election storyline and possibly Sam's part in it will actually take place before the battle. That will be a major part of Castle Black's storyline through the season. That's about the only way they could do it, because I just don't see them fitting all that into episode 10. If anything, I see maybe the inner workings, or that plot being forward, the fact that Jon has been nominated, and then that being kind of a cliffhanger for next season. Because, you know, a lot of times, I think in particular at the end of season 1, where they showed badass things happening with people, and that could be one of the things, the brothers casting their votes or something like that. The end, you know, one of the upbeat scenes that's like, well, he had the battle at the wall, you know, is going to win command of the Night's Watch, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my thoughts on it. We're going to move into the tinfoil theory of the week. Again, this is kind of like the spoilers beyond the wall segment. This is, we're going past just what's happened in the books, just things that involve the series. And we're going to start talking about predicting the future for what's going to happen in the next books. So I'm just giving you fair warning, we're about to shift into that. We're going to talk about some feedback we had from last week's, and then I'm wanting to delve into a really, really fun theory. But first, get through some emails from last week. Lewis Fleek says, regarding your first tinfoil conspiracy discussion on R plus L equals J, I want to remind you of one particular point. As far as we know, there's one person left alive who knows the truth of what happened at the Tower of Joy, and that's Howland Reed. I forgot to mention that. I was actually going to mention that as a segue, and I totally forgot about it. So thanks for bringing that up. We also know that since Robert's Rebellion, Lord Reed has not left his swamps in the neck north of the Riverlands. We're also told that he's one of Ned's closest friends and perhaps the Stark's most loyal bannerman. Finally, GRRM said in one of his public appearances that we will eventually meet Howland Reed. All that comes from information gained from the Wiki of Ice and Fire and related sites. I think when the reveal happens, it will be Lord Reed that provides the testimony legitimizing Jon Snow as a Targaryen prince. As a noble lord, Howland Reed has a social standing to make such a claim and be believed. It would be famously or infamously known as the one of the men who helped defeat the three greatest living knights of the Kingsguard. My official prediction is that Lord Reed eventually publicly testifies that Jon is Targaryen, and as part of the Targaryen restoration, Jon marries Daenerys, and the two of the three heads of the reborn dragon mirroring Aegon the Conqueror's incestuous relationship with his warrior sisters. In Breaking Good style, you can officially put me down for that prediction. That is certainly the two most popular identities for the heads of the dragon, Jon and Dany. Really, the only evidence is, well, Martin doesn't do happy endings, and that's too night, neat, and tidy. Okay, fine. I do have a little quibble about Howland Reed's social standing. Most of the Crannigan men don't have any social standing. Even the Northern Lords are kind of looked down upon them. So I don't know that he'll have, it's what he has to say isn't going to probably mean a lot to the Tyrells and the Lannisters of the realm. However, really all he has to convince for your heads of the dragon to come true is Dany. And shit, Dany seems to take on anybody. I mean, she's got a disgraced knight in her retinue, someone that made common cause with her father's betrayer and served with the Kingslayer as another. She's got a fucking pirate and sellsword as a consort. You know, she put slavers in office. It seems like anyone that she thinks can help, she'll accept. So I can see her believing Howland Reed for sure and not having a big pretense about it. So anyway, again, like that theory. And again, Howland Reed is the only living person that knows about it. There might be a possibility Benjen Stark. And I got a whole segment. I'm not sure when I'm going to bust this out on the identity of Benjen Stark and whether or not he survives. Because if anyone else would know, it would be Benjen, right? Ed Stark's brother. I can see him telling him the family secret. So that's another possibility. But that's, as we say, tinfoil for another day. Chris Dana, or Dana, from Orange County, California, who was nice enough to come to our meetup in San Diego at Stone Brewery. We had a real good time. He sent in an email saying, I've only read the first book, and that was over 6 months ago, but I listened to spoilers because I'm a glutton for punishment. He's one of those ones that I talk about who just doesn't care about spoilers, doesn't give a shit. That said, I enjoyed the Jon Snow theory, but I have two points or counterpoints. The first is that Jon Snow is dark-haired, which is the way our fallen Stark House leader Ned figured out that Joffrey and his little brother and sisters aren't Robert Baratheon's children, and therefore not true heirs to the throne because they were blonde-headed. I guess we aren't given enough information if this applies to every family or bloodline in Westeros. Well, it can't, because Rob's hair is, I believe, dark, isn't it? At least Arya's is for sure, and she's definitely a child of Ned and Catelyn both. But you know, Catelyn's got the auburn hair, which Sansa has. I can't freaking really remember Rob. I know in the show he's got dark curly hair, and Rickon. But they all said they have the Tully look, so I assume in the books they kind of all, you know, kind of favor her. So I don't think it's just anyone, you know, that the father seed, I think that was one of the points that John Arryn was mentioning, that seed is strong with the Baratheons, and that unusually so, that King Robert fathered 50 bastards, and they all have black hair, but all of his children are golden hair. What's the odds of that? And again, you know, biologically speaking, that doesn't quite line up. It's shit, we're talking about dragons and long winters and stuff, so I'm not too worried about that. Your other point is more minor, you say, and it might just prove that John isn't the quote-unquote dragon, but he burns his hand saving the Lord Commander from the White in his chambers at the end of Season 1. This doesn't disprove anything, as he could still be a Targaryen, as Viserys was, and still burn from his beautiful golden crown. And Amanda T had similar comments about the Targaryens, a true dragon, being fireproof. Interestingly enough, the word of Martin is that that was a one-time magical event, Dany's resistance to fire, which is kind of belied in the show, and it's kind of annoying to me, because when I talk to Jim, that's something he likes to bring up about a Targaryen trait, and it's not really. In fact, in Dance with Dragons, Dany does get burnt. Not severely, but definitely scorched, and, you know, second degree burns and all that kind of stuff. At least, maybe even a third degree here or there. So, again, word of Martin says that's a one-time magical event that had more to do with the blood magic that Dany inadvertently did by sacrificing the witch. And that's what also brought the dragons back, and that's what preserved her life. So it's kind of like the spell that the witch put on her by sacrificing her in that fire and be willing to sacrifice herself, it like Harry Potter style rebounded and kept her alive and also restored these dragons as her children. Kind of fucked up, but that's what Martin says. All right, so let's get into the main event, the new tinfoil theory. Last week, honestly, is not so much a theory. It's like it's a theory in the sense that gravity is a theory. I suppose someone somewhere could find some grand unification theory that disproves everything we know about gravity. Yet you still drop an apple, it's going to hit the ground. You know, it might not work exactly the way, but the basic facts are the same. I think that at this point, if Martin backs away from the L plus R equals J theory, that he's going to have a lot of explaining to do. I mean, if it turns out to be somebody like, shit, Sam, for example, the Slayer, that he's actually the prince that was promised, that's actually not a bad idea. I might have to come up with a tinfoil theory to support that. look forward to that in the future. But what I'm saying is, like, if it's anybody else at the wall but John, with that blue flower growing out of a chink in the ice, it's going to be almost a betrayal for me. So that's a solid theory. This week, definite tinfoil material, but on the scale of tinfoil, I would say it's more like Reynolds Wrap, heavy duty, 36 inch wide aluminum foil. This is no mere, you know, wrapper on your ding dong. Which, if you're old enough to remember ding dongs, the hostess product, this isn't like a condom joke. Ding dongs used to be wrapped in really flimsy tinfoil wrappers before they got shrink wrapped like they are now. Anyway, Roose Bolton, Vampire Lord, also known as the also known as the Bolton applied directly to the head forehead theory. Yeah, that's where you can, if you want to search on the internet, you could probably search Roose Vampire or Bolton Reddit Vampire, something like that. The Roose is loose, the Spruce Roose, any other pun you want to make. That's this theory. It all started off a couple months ago on Reddit. Someone posted to the Song of Ice and Fire subreddit, which, again, if you're not a book reader, Jesus, stay the hell off of that one. Game of Thrones is bad. The Game of Thrones subreddit is bad enough, but Song of Ice and Fire, all they do is sit and analyze all the books and even the preview chapters and the Duncan Egg Chronicles and all that crap. But someone posted a thread, "What hunch do you believe but cannot prove?" And a guy named J.B. Talley said that Roose Bolton has been alive for thousands of years and has been impersonating various figures around Westeros during that time. He is the Night King's son, and he used leeches to preserve his body. And people are like, wow, that is pretty impressive. And he didn't have any support for this. He just spit it out there. There was some theories in the Westeros.org site about Roose being the son of the Night's King, or the Bolton. Actually, is the Bolton's lineage stems from the Night King, And we're going to talk about that here in a minute. But this really set one particular Redditor's mind on fire, whose name is Madge312, M-A-J-312. He is kind of like a Bolton scholar. Most of his posts had to do with the Boltons and Ruse in particular. And he submitted something soon after that about how Ruse Bolton age is just a number. And he says, and again, these theories are not mine. These are theories I found on the internet. None of this stuff is my original thought. I'll let you know if I ever have one, and I'll crow about it. But this is I don't want to take credit for these. These are just stuff I found on the internet. He says, GRRM hints a couple times that Ruse is well past, quote-unquote, the age of 40. He then talks about like how old he might be, and he cites evidence that the younger sister of Ruse's second wife is Barbary Dustin. She's described by the Westeros Wiki as thus. She has wrinkles around her eyes and mouth. She is still tall, unbent, and handsome. Her hair is equal parts brown and gray, wearing it tied behind her head in a widow's knot. So we see this woman, who is the younger sister of Ruse's second wife, which is kind of saying that this woman is younger than Ruse, you'd assume, is graying and wrinkled. Okay. As another example, Domerick Bolton was Ruse's legitimate son and heir. And we're going to talk about this later, but he was murdered by Ramsay because he didn't like a legitimate heir being in front of him as a bastard. He's described in the books as being able to outrace Lyanna Stark, who you'll recall we talked about last week, on horseback. So you can make an inference from that, right? You can infer that Domerick had to be old enough to ride a full-size horse while Lyanna was still alive. Since she dies 14 years before the events of Game of Thrones, this means that she's likely just a few years younger than Ned Stark. Lyanna was her younger sister. You know, Domerick was of an age of her. So we're kind of, and we know Ned was in his like 30s. So that kind of puts a lower limit on how old Ruse can be. His second line of evidence was, or third line of evidence rather, is Ruse also has a namesake, Ruse Risewell. This is the brother of Ruse's second wife. And he points out for someone to be named after someone else, the original Ruse must have been a man of some note at the time of Ruse Risewell's birth. I have a slight quibble of that because just marrying his sister, older sister, could be reason enough for someone to name someone after somebody. But it's a reasonably strong theory. Why would you name someone after somebody unless they'd done something to distinguish themselves? So we're not sure if he's an older or younger brother, but he's not likely to be more than 20 years younger if he is, you know, because again, Westeros, if you're, you know, mom started having babies when she was 16 and she called it quits at 40 or a little bit after that, which would be unusual. That's kind of constrains on how old you can be between younger, oldest and youngest sibling. But in the book, when he's introduced, he's kind of introduced as one of those characters who's in his mid-30s or early 40s. That would make Ruse around late 50s to early to mid 60s or older. And yet this is how he's described as in the books. Reek describes him, though Ruse has been in battles, he bore no scars. Though well past 40, he has yet unwrinkled with scarce a line to tell the passage of time. There is an agelessness about him, a stillness on Ruse Bolton's face. Rage and joy looked much the same. All he and Ramsay had in common were their eyes. His eyes are ice. So he pointed out, asked the question, can leechings alone, because that's one thing we know about the Boltons. He's crazy about leeches. He's crazy about blood. He talks a lot of times about, you know, blood being inflamed or purity of blood or blood being poison or hot blood. He's always leeching himself all over his body frequently, many times a day. Almost obsessed with it. Can these leechings explain his youthful good looks? Well, about a month later, Madge312 followed up on Ruse's age analysis with the groundbreaking theory that he was in fact a vampire. Now keep in mind, this isn't as crazy as it might first appear, okay? I mean, we've got this theme, wargs, people warging in the wolves is an obvious kind of homage to the werewolf mythology. With Qyburn and Sir Robert Strong, Martin's making a very obvious reference to Frankenstein and his monster. And In fact, that's kind of a theory onto its own, the whole Robert Strong identity. But when I finally got to it in the books, it seemed incredibly obvious his real identity and how this thing happened. So I'm just assuming it as fact. But if it is, then we've got an obvious Frankenstein reference here. So we got werewolves, we got vampires, we got skin changers. Can vampires really be that far-fetched if you got this universe populated with classic horror monster tropes? You know, Martin must be a fan of these guys. So would he put a vampire lord in here? Well, let's look at his evidence. His thesis was there's only been one Bolton patriarch. And in support, he says that recall the faceless men and their methods for disguise. And if you haven't gotten that far, or if you don't recall, basically, when Arya finally becomes a full-fledged acolyte, she's allowed access to the lowest level of the Faceless Man's temple. And she finds that it's populated by endless rows of faces. All kinds of faces. Men, women, beggars, rich people, beautiful people, ugly people, people with disease, people with scars, just hundreds if not thousands of people's faces. And the head acolyte, what is his name? The Merciful Man or the Quiet Man? I can't recall. He does something where he has her close her eyes, he cuts her forehead, he sticks this face on her, and when she opens her eyes back up, she is taken on this person's face. It's like a living mask, like Mission Impossible style. And that's one of the levels of magic that the Faceless Men are able to employ to do their job. So we see that this technology of changing faces and changing skins exists in this world. It's not a speculation. That's a fact. And again, that's blood magic because you have to get it all wet with a wearer's blood for it to take, right? We know the Bolton is a very ancient house, that they've been bitter rivals to the Starks back when the Starks were kings in the North. Magic was very commonplace back then. We also know from the oral histories handed down that many Starks were wargs. And people wonder, you know, if you got these magically powerful Starks in Winterfell with their warging abilities, it's such a huge and obvious advantage over the Boltons, how would they survive this feud against this superior enemy with their magical powers? Also recall that the Boltons were known to have worn the skins of their enemies as cloaks. Even their claim that even a few Starks met that fate and ended up getting flayed in the halls of the Dreadfort. They've been flaying people since the Age of Heroes, which goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Perhaps they've mastered the art of skin changing the Faceless Men now use. You know, think about what kind of havoc you'd wreak among your enemies if you could just appear as one of them at a crucial moment, if you're captured or you're about to be captured. Think of, you know, the simple trick that Reek / Ramsay pulled on Roderick Castle. That came back to reclaim Winterfell, and he pretended he was on his side and he massacred everybody. Well, if you can actually appear to be the person's lord or a close relative of that, it could really, you know, fuck shit up. Then also Ramsay, you know, why does Roos put up with Ramsay? They're nothing really alike in personality except for maybe cruelty, if you believe some of the excesses of the Boltons. Roos despises boy lords, of course, and since Ramsay's slain all of his true-born heirs, and because of his age, he's resigned to make the most of a bad situation. But, you know, we've already talked about Roose seeming to be in perfect health. Even if he's 60, there shouldn't be any problem with fathering additional children. Why doesn't he think he wouldn't live for another 20 years? If he, say, is 60 years old, why wouldn't he live to 80? Why couldn't he dispose of Ramsay and start over again? What if there's another reason that Roose was keeping Ramsay alive? Why did Roos spare Ramsay when he first found out that he had a bastard? Because the book makes a point that Ramsay had his same eyes. Roos, Madge 312 puts forth, is keeping Ramsay around because he plans on stealing Ramsay's identity. He plans on stealing his face because Roos is immortal. And in fact, the son of the Night King. So let's talk about some evidence about this Bolton springing from the Night King. We're going to go all the way back to Game of Thrones with some of the stories that old Dan is telling Bran. Quote here, the gathering gloom put Bran in mind of another age, or a mind of another one of old Nan's stories, the tale of the Night's King. He had been the 13th man to lead the Night's Watch. a warrior who knew no fear, and that was the fault in him, she would add, for all men must know fear. A woman was his downfall, a woman glimpsed from atop the wall, with skin as white as the moon and eyes like blue stars. Fearing nothing, he chased her and caught her and loved her, though her skin was cold as ice, and when he gave his seed to her, he gave her his soul as well. He brought her back to the night fort and proclaimed her a queen and himself her king, and with strange sorceries he bound the sworn brothers to his will. For 13 years they had ruled, knight's king and corpse queen, till finally the Stark of Winterfell and Joramun of the Wildlings had joined to free the Watch from bondage. After his fall, when it was found that he had been sacrificing to the others, all records of the knight's king had been destroyed and his very name had been forbidden. Some say he was a Bolton, old Nan would always end. And I hasten to add that she then said, maybe he's an Umber, or maybe he's a Karstark, or hell, you know, really, I think he was really a Stark, and who knows, he might have slept in your very bedroom one day just to scare the shit out of Bran, right? So, some people say that this woman the Night King fell in love with was an other herself. Judging by her eyes and skin color and temperature, you know, she had these bright blue eyes, ice cold skin. Sounds like another to me, right? And note that it says he gave his seed to her. Now, to me, that goes beyond him just fucking her, but it implies that they had offspring, that he got a child from her. MAJ312 sums up this theory, and I'll quote, he says, what if this half-other, half-human offspring had a child? That child grew to be an adult, but then ceased to age. How could the strange creature continue his existence while living in the world of men? It must pretend. It must be cautious. This is where the vampire theory comes in. It must look like it lives and dies and gives birth to heirs like men do. And when it has lived for 50 or 60 years, not long enough for its unlined face and dark hair to draw too much attention, it flays the sun with pale eyes and assumes his identity. He quotes A Dance with Dragons on page 48, where Roose Bolton, it's described as Roose Bolton's own face is a pale gray mask with two chips of dirty ice where his eyes should be. He kind of says that that's like Martin giving a wink about this true identity here. So let's consider some other supporting evidence, the others in the comment threads and other forums put forth. Roose does a lot of creepy shit during his time at Harrenhal, where Arya served as his page, similar to how to show Arya served Tywin. She comments on his coldness and his fondness for frequent leechings, but check out this passage from A Clash of Kings. Roose Bolton was seated by the hearth, reading from a thick leather-brown book when she entered Arya. Light some candles, he commanded as he turned the page. It grows gloomy in here. She placed the food at his elbow and did as he bid her, filling the room with flickering light and the scent of cloves. Bolton turned a few more pages with his finger and then closed the book and placed it carefully in the fire. He watched the flames consume it, pale eyes shining with reflected light. The old dry leather went up with a whoosh. The yellow pages stirred as they burned as if some ghost were reading them. I'll have no further need of you tonight, he said, never looking at her. Creepy ass shit. Why is Roose burning ancient books? Could it be books regarding Bolton lineage that might raise some uncomfortable questions regarding the Bolton's family line? House Lothston of Harrenhal was an extinct house of the Riverlands. They held Harrenhal for 3 or 4 generations before the events in the books and were a powerful house which once loomed large in the histories of the Seven Kingdoms. Their arms were a black bat on a field divided bendwise, silver and gold. Lady Danielle Lothston was said to send giant bats out to capture children for her cookpots. And a mad Lady Lothston, which is possibly the same Danielle, is said to have bathed in blood and feasted on flesh. Maybe this book was a book on blood magic that the mad Lady Lothston has kept around, and Roose was taking advantage of inhabiting the Harrenhal to brush up on his own blood magic and then burn them to keep other people from finding his secrets. Or maybe Roose is just into burning ancient books in the middle of the bloody night. Who the hell knows, right? But it's weird. It's something that's consistent with something you'd read Dracula doing, right? Also, why is Roose so damn fond of leeching? Well, maybe he needs the leeching to draw the blood into his skin to keep it alive. We know modern medicine has come back around to using leeches to improve the vascularity of reattached limbs and skin grafts. Because it encourages capillary growth and avoids these things from getting necrotized. keeps him healthy. Maybe Roos needs these leeches to keep his various assumed skins appearing fresh and healthy too, and that's why he has to be leeched all the damn time, or else he'd start looking like a fucking white. And we're not just talking about his face, we're talking about a whole skin operation. That's the way the Boltons roll. It's the Bolton way. Consider their banner, the flayed man, literally a man without skin. Could that actually be the representation of the Lord of the Dreadfort, his true form, that he then covers with the skins of his victims, that he's been flaunting to the other lords of Westeros without their knowledge for thousands of years? It's right in their face. The flayed man isn't a symbol of their fallen enemies, it's the fucking Lord of the Dreadfort himself. Now, thematically, this makes sense. The Starks, we talked about this, werewolves slash wargs, Boltons, vampires, are perfect natural rivals. It's a common trope in horror, literature, and cinema since the days of Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney Jr. You see it in its modern forms in Underworld and True Blood and, yes, fucking Twilight. So, again, if Martin's going for this, it makes perfect thematic sense. Roos has a saying, a peaceful land and a quiet people. This has some parallels. You know, he believes in, you know, justice, firm justice, but not the kind of wanton cruelty and bloodshed that his son is into, because then the people are quiet and they're easy to rule. And this has parallels with historical and mythical Dracula stories, who said to use brutal methods to maintain law and order in his realm, but indeed, his realm had peace. Legend says Dracula kept a golden cup in his town's central fountain so that people could drink from it. And no one ever stole from it, because they did, they'd fucking get impaled. So why keep Ramsay alive, who's this brutal madman, for no reason but for his own pleasure? There's no good end to this shit that Ramsay did. He just did it to terrorize people because he's sick. What would you keep someone like that alive if your mantra is peaceful land, quiet people? Well, it makes perfect sense if he's just raising Ramsay for his pelt. He doesn't give a shit. In another couple years, he's going to harvest it, take on Ramsay's identity, and suddenly Ramsay's going to chill the fuck out. He's going to stop doing all this shit, and the people will begin to love him and, you know, stop fomenting rebellion. Do the Double D's have any insider knowledge for the show? Some people think it's very suspicious that Roos tossed off this line to Walder Frey, rural juror, to Walder Frey in episode 10 of the third season, just after the Red Wedding. They're talking about the young wolf, and he toasts, and then he has this really creepy, like, saying, "Forever young." Then we cut directly to Ramsay at the Dreadfort. They're saying that's a sly parallel. It's kind of intriguing. Another logical thing to consider is, why would Roos ever be in the same place as Ramsay? Aside from House Arryn, Bolton's got to be the easiest house in the world to just crush. All you got to do is kill two guys, and you're done. No more male heirs. House over. You can sack and take over. In the novels, most other major houses have many sons, and they keep one of them behind in their fortresses or keeps or steadfast or castles or whatever. When they go off adventuring to war to maintain their bloodline, it makes good sense. But Roos goes ahead and puts Ramsay and himself, his sole heir and himself, in some ruined enemy castle, surrounded by people of questionable loyalty, while the Dreadfort remains empty. That seems to be really stupid, a really stupid strategic move on his part, when so far he's played everything so perfectly, so brilliantly. But it doesn't seem as stupid if he has some other reason to be sure of his survival, like the fact that he's some immortal abomination that's been alive for thousands of years. One final point to ponder. I mentioned above that Ramsay kills all of Roos's children, and maybe he did kill his eldest son, Domerick, but Roos also mentioned the possibilities of having many other children. This is a quote from Roos in the books, says, "Lady Walda is a Frey, and she has a fertile feel to her. I've become oddly fond of my fat little wife. The two before her never made a sound in bed, but this one squeals and shudders, and I find that quite endearing. She pops out sons the way she pops in tarts, the dreadful fort will soon be overrun with Boltons. Ramsay will kill them all, of course. That's for the best. I will not live long enough to see my new sons to manhood. The boy lords are the bane of any house. Walda will grieve to see them die, though." So we see Roos foresees having many more children, but suspects Ramsay will murder them all. But what if that's just a cover? He kept his firstborn alive to keep his skin. He suffers his bastard to live for the same reasons. But the skin-changing vampire lord theory is correct. Maybe he's indulging in some other more other-like behaviors, White Walker-like behaviors, such as child sacrifice, like a Craster's Keep. What the hell does the others do with those male children that they take anyway? People theorize maybe they make more of themselves, or maybe there's some blood magic involved that sustains them and they feed off this life energy. The same blood magic that Roos needs as well. And now he has a fat, fertile wife that can supply him like a baby factory, punching out babies like movie tickets. It seems horrible, right? Even for Roos. But consider what he just said before this passage about his son Domeric. He said, "Now his bones lie beneath the Dreadfort, the bones of his brothers, who died still in the cradle, and I am left with Ramsay." It's not even the first time Bolton children have died mysteriously in their cribs, all males. This is starting to sound more and more like Craster-ish business. Why is he making his moves to acquire power in the North now after being kept in heel and in check by the Starks for centuries? Well, simple. He's half other. Winter is coming, the long night. His time is at hand. He can feel it. So now he's setting to make the entire North a staging area for the others to welcome his long-lost relatives back into their time of power on Westeros. Again, it's probably bullshit, but I think it's one of the cooler of the kooky theories and actually has a surprising lot of support in the source material. Curious to see what you thought of that. It's radically different from the L plus R equals J. Again, if you have other theories that you'd like me to consider, keep sending them in. I've got a pretty long to-do list at this point. We'll be talking about some theories and speculation about Jack and Hagar's identities as they shift throughout the novels. We'll be talking about the tinfoilist of tinfoil, Benjen Stark. What's his present identity? We'll be talking about the Grand Northern Conspiracy and also an analysis of the many prophecies regarding to Dany and how by they look at the end of Dance with Dragons. So that's coming in the weeks ahead. If you've got some others that I didn't mention there, please send them in and we'll get them slotted. Had a lot of fun doing the research on this as always. If you've got comments on this or any other spoiler section, please send it in to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. And that's it for the spoiler section. Hope you enjoyed the cast, and I will see you next Sunday after the second episode of Game of Thrones Season 4. Thanks for listening. Talk to you then.